I must say, I'm quite impressed with the work that was being done by SAS management in terms of the B2R. I think the two outstanding issues has been dealt with. So I think we'll just take those two slides, General, at the end of the three presentations, the one dealing, I think, with the one is the workshop, the other one is rural safety. But rural safety, of course, we're going to deal with Friday. So I think in terms of the BRRR, we're absolutely on course. And I think it's good work done by SAPS. Just to let me miss in Friday the 29th of the 26th, we will get a briefing from the Human Rights Commission, AgriSA, the Agricultural Act Association, SAPS on the Rural Safety Plan. The presentation was already distributed to members. And as we've indicated yesterday, Wednesday, 31 August, we will have SAPS coming back to us on FOPS, where we are in terms of FALM, procurement plan for equipment, specialized vehicles, as well as the first quarter and the last quarter. So that's for the next 2 weeks, more or less, our going to be our focus areas. Maybe just to indicate to is on
Chairperson, if I may, seeing that you've mentioned for Friday, I apologize that I'm not here on Friday. I have a federal executive council and I'm the chair there. But I made a submission to the Human Rights Commission on rural safety and farm murders, so you'll see my presentation there.
Take a note of your absence on Friday, and we'll take note of your input with regard to that as well. Maybe just to indicate to our delegation, to the general, we yesterday had the DTCI with us in terms of the presentation. Maybe it's two issues, but I don't think we have to deal with that. Maybe next week when we come, the issue of, again, I think program one, the issue of buildings, accommodation, was sharply raised by them as an issue. That indicated there is a concession being taken, but that's the issue I think we need to address as a matter of priority, the state of the building that is identified. So I just want to highlight that. And I think there was also media reports during the last weeks of the state of the SAPS Training College in Pretoria. So I just want to know, alert you on those issues, that issues that maybe next week we can just get feedback on where we are in terms of, you know, dealing with those issues going forward. I will then ask the honourable members to introduce themselves, and then I'll give an opportunity to the general planning.
The member of our High Committee. Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sinde Mola, a member of this Control Committee. Thank you.
I am Jerome Mage, a member of this committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sanbonani Kamusakel and Bele, member of the committee.
Goedemorgen, dames en heren. Dit is Pieter Groenewald en ik is ook een lid van die committee.
Thank you very much, honourable members. I think honourable Ramathakani indicated he's not well, so he's attended his apologies. So we must certainly give any other apologies. Okay. Thanks. We'll then ask the acting national commissioner, John Collins.
Good morning, honourable chair, honourable members. We appreciate the opportunity to present us before you as part of our responsibility to account. I am with a delegation, I'll introduce them on my immediate left, Lieutenant General Ngwenya, the Deputy National Commissioner responsible for Human Resource Management, Lieutenant General Masemola, the Deputy National Commissioner responsible for Policing, Lieutenant General Mawela, the Additional Commissioner responsible for Operational Response Services, Lieutenant General Marcia, who is the Additional Commissioner for Physical Policing, Lieutenant General Ngomo, the Additional Commissioner responsible for Detective Services, Mr. General Mahele, the Acting Additional Commissioner of Crime Intelligence, Major General Ravi, the Head of Strategic Management. We also have amongst us Brigadier Kumalo, who is here behind me. He is the session unit operations from the division ORS, Brigadier Marshal Philippe, the spokesperson for the Acting National Commissioner, and Colonel Stein, the parliamentary officer of the South African Police Service. Honorable Chair, we are grateful that we are here. We are beyond the election process, which kept us busy. But I, in advance, want to express my appreciation to the members of the South African Police Service, including our colleagues within the cluster, who did the work towards ensuring that democracy prevails. I also want to express our appreciation for the support we got from the community at large, the cooperation, because without the community, it would not have been possible for us to deliver a safe and secure election. And importantly, support from yourselves in supporting us to ensure that we execute our duties. We are indebted to all of those that contributed immensely to a good cause. Thank you very much.
Very much, General. I think that three pleasant passions flow into each other as such, but I think what we're going to do is let's start with a deployment one first of the elections. And I think if there's specific questions we can go to it, but I think the Tshwane as well as the crime intelligence, there's also issues. So let's see how it goes and then we can, you know, go for questions immediately after the first one. But I think there will be issues in the other two presentations that might come up in the first round. General Bafani, over to you.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. We will do the presentations as requested. I'll ask General Ravi to take us through all presentations. If that enjoys the chair, that will work. Thank you, sir.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, good morning from my side. As you requested, sir, the Chairperson, the first presentation will focus on the general deployment approach during the local government elections, and then other presentations will follow that will address specific issues that have been raised by the committee. As far as the general approach to the local government elections is concerned, we will just touch on the introduction. I focus on the identified role players involved in the process. There will be discussion on the three-phased approach and the security concept that were applicable. We will also focus on the identified hotspots and then deployment strategy in terms of phase 1, 2 and 3, case management, and we will end the presentation by means of a conclusion. As far as the introduction is concerned, the planning for the local government elections that took place recently started in 2015, and the total planning process around that was coordinated through the Joint Operation Intelligence Structure, or the joints, to ensure that there's integrated efforts and that we have free and fair elections. Now, as far as the different levels are concerned, we had the NAT joints at national level that's responsible for strategic coordination, management and monitoring of safeguarding operations. Then at provincial level, PROC joints responsible for planning, coordination and implementation at provincial and local level. And at interdepartmental priority committees were established at both national and provincial level, and they were co-chaired by the South Africa Police Service and Independent Electoral Commission. And the purpose of these committees was to coordinate safety and security planning. As far as the role players are concerned, they are listed there, but they include the Independent Electoral Commission, the South African Police Service, the Department of Defense, the State Security Agency, Metro Police, Disaster Management, Emergency Medical Response Services, Departments of Home Affairs, Higher Education, Basic Education, the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa, GOCTA and the Demarcation Board, the Department of Justice, Correctional Services, the Government Communication Information Systems, South African Weather Service, and the Departments of Health and Social Development. Now, as we previously indicated in the introduction, there was a three-phase approach that was followed during the total election process, and phase one specifically focused on the build-up to the election activities from February to July 2016. And the specific activities that we attended to during that specific process or during the phase was, first of all, the screening of IEC officials and service providers, intelligence collection, analysis, and coordination in terms of the aim to identify or determine threat assessment, identify the specific hotspots. There was also intensified stabilization operations in the identified hotspot areas, the securing of voter registration dates, the policing of political gatherings, rallies, and demonstrations in terms of the Regulation of Gathering Act, and the investigation of related cases that have been reported during the specific period. During phase two, that includes the special voting day and the voting day from the 1st to the 3rd of August 2016, the focus was on the following. Was intelligence collection, analysis, and coordination, once again focusing on the threat assessment associated with the elections, the categorization of hotspots and voting stations. The second target was the enhanced visibility in the identified hotspot areas, escorting of voting material and the IEC staff, static protection at voting stations, roving reaction teams to attend to specific threats, especially at medium and high risk areas, national reaction team that consists of the identified specialized units, and we continued with the investigation of related cases during that specific process. During phase three, that's the post-election days, starting from the 4th August 2016, the focus was still on intelligence collection, analysis, and coordination, specific focus still on the threat assessment and identification and addressing hotspots, policing of gatherings in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, the stability operations in areas where problems were identified, and enhancing visibility in hotspot areas, and once again, continuing through the whole three phases in investigation of cases that's been reported during this period. Now, as far as the identified hotspots are concerned, that the number of areas that were required intervention prior to the government election amounted to the numbers that are indicated there. Based on violent protests against, protest actions and criminal activities, those are the numbers, Limpopo 56 cases in 40, Gauteng 36, Northwest 30, Western Cape 25, Eastern Cape 23, Mpumalanga 12, Northern Cape 7, and Free State 3. And then based on demarcation queries and complaints in the different provinces, 9 in Limpopo, 7 in KZN, 7 in Eastern Cape, Northwest 5, GP Gauteng 3, Free State 3, Western Cape 2, Mpumalanga, and Northern Cape 1 each. Now, the majority of these areas were affected by the nomination processes against demarcation results and political tension, which would have resulted in political campaigns and it could have affected the IEC activities. The interventions in the forms of stability operations that we had to stabilize, that we had to ensure that we stabilize the situation was paramount, ensuring that we have free and fair elections. Now, our deployment strategy that is applicable during phase one, now as we indicated, the specific focus was on intelligence gathering, and as a result of that, hotspots were identified by the established intelligence gathering coordinating committee made up that of the SASCOM intelligence, Defense Intelligence, State Security Agency, and the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee based on various issues. The National Intervention Stability Operations were conducted in some priority hotspots that included Kuani and Limpopo, Kwamashu in KZN, Umlazi in KZN, Mandini in KZN, and Ongoma. And where in those specific areas, the National Specialized Units, the NIU, TRP, and POP units were deployed from national levels. All clusters with hotspots conducted three operations, three times within enhanced police visibility, and all these operations that we conducted during phase one were intelligence-driven operations. Moving to phase two, the deployment strategy during that specific phase on the election days, the responsibility was to secure election warehouses, materials, and provide escort duties for the deliveries of voting material and personnel. It also included static protection of voting stations, the inner perimeter security at all voting stations, static deployment of visible policing at 22,612 voting stations, on a 2-4-6 ratio as determined by the threat assessment and the need for reaction in those specific situations. We just need to indicate a correction in terms of the deployment indicated that it was the low-risk areas were two police members. And that included 20,364 voting districts. At the medium-risk areas, the deployment was four police members. That included 1,328 voting districts. And then the high-risk areas is six police members and not four as indicated there. And the identified high-risk areas included 650 voting districts. Okay, and those deployments that are listed there and that was actually done during the election process were informed by the gathering of intelligence on the daily basis, and when necessary, it was adapted according to specific threats that has been identified. The deployment of police in terms of this plan does not affect the day-to-day policing at station level. One of the priorities was to ensure that we continue with normal policing activities within the specific station areas. Deployment strategy still were phase two escort duties. That included, focus was on 220,000 IEC staff and material to the identified 22,612 voting districts. That the deployment was one police vehicle and two police members, and then also 20 NIU members was dedicated to escorting of IEC commissioners. The static protection at warehouses where election material was stored, that is your 9 warehouses, that included 2 police members for each one of these identified warehouses. The holding reaction team at cluster level that we placed, that was placed at your high risk and medium risk areas for the specific intent to react in the incidents that were identified. It was strategically placed within each voting district in order to deal with other situations affecting the voting process. Now, with specific reference to the strategic placing is to ensure that they could be optimally deployed within the time that has been required. The focus was to deal with crowd management situations. The CRT included there was to deal with medium risk situation, and then the National Intervention Unit, they were dedicated to deal with the medium to high risk situations. Now, the total breakdown of the SAP's deployment on the 3 days of the elections, during the first day, the total deployment was 60,480. On the second day, that increased to 64,197. And on the third day, the total SAP's deployment was 98,803 SAP's members. Now, as far as the still moving with phase two of the elections, running teams at provincial level, We also placed the roving teams strategically within hotspot provinces to deal with higher risk situations. And the national reaction team were made of the special task force, national intervention unit, and mobile operations units that were deployed in KZN. The total deployment there was 90, Limpopo 105, and Gauteng province 90. It is also important to note that the SNDF was deployed only for logistical purposes, for example, with air support. And the ground forces were placed on standby, as was decided at that time by the executive level. The disaster management contingency interventions, this was coordinated at national level to provide for the relief of voters in situation of natural and man-made disasters. The plan was first activated in the Eastern Cape and Free State on a rescue mission as a result of snow, the bad weather that moved in over that specific day. Secondly, in the Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Free State, and Gauteng as a result of extreme wind conditions on the voting day. Communication plan, election-related mandated communication was managed by the GCIS and the IEC, and that included election-related communication that was dealt with by IEC, and then government included safety and security communication that was dealt with by the GCIS. During phase three, that included the post-election period, first for responsibility refers to escorting after closing of voting station, election materials and IEC officials from voting stations to the established result centers. Second responsibility was the securing of national and provincial IEC result centers, activation of venues and specific reference to operational centers within the result centers, the additional deployment of SAPS employees around these result centers, and then there was also a hotline established within the NATJOC and the provincial JOCs. Releasing of related celebrations and festivities, the aim of the exercise was to maintain law and order during these celebrations, and then also to apply the regulations of the Gathering Act and Safety at Sport and Recreational Events Act. Case management, all criminal cases that relates to the 2016 local government elections that were reported were investigated and monitored since 1 February 2016. Case management protocol involving the DPCI, SAS detectives and NPA was developed in order to ensure that there's an integrated approach to the investigation of these cases. Most of the cases reported relates to the contravention of local government municipal electoral act and some serious crimes that included murders, attempted murders, assault, GBH, arson, and malicious damage to property. The investigation of these cases will be monitored on a monthly basis until they are finalized. And just quickly a synopsis of the cases that's been reported during this specific period, 1 February 2016 to 5 August 2016. There is a provincial breakdown. In total, the number of cases reported is 782, with the highest numbers reported in Gauteng, 394, Limpopo, 112, KwaZulu-Natal is 9 and the rest of the provinces are listed there. The detail is reflected in terms of what's the current status of these dockets, and kind enough that you will notice as far as the guilty and the not guilty and the court process are concerned, the statistics are currently low, and we need to take note of the fact that these cases still need to go through the total board process. But just highlighting some, in Gauteng you will note that out of the 394, 111 cases were referred to court, 223 is still under investigation, and the total number of suspects arrested is 290. In KwaZulu-Natal, 90 cases, of which 18 has been referred to court and 43 suspects have been arrested, and in the also Limpopo with 112 cases, 22 has been referred to court and 72 of those are currently under investigation, of 74 suspects has been arrested. The rest of the detail is available on the specific slide. The election-related cases in terms of the 2011, in the East, you'll note that in the 2011 election process, the number of cases that are reported there, that amounted to 604. If we go back to the previous one, you will see there's an increase in the number of cases that's been reported. It went up from 604 to 728. Now, so those cases has been reported a long time ago. You will note that the majority of them have basically been dealt through the court process. We had 45 guilties, 23 not guilty. 112 were closed undetected and 423 were withdrawn in court. So in total, that is just a quick reference to the number of cases and the outcomes that were reported during the 2011 elections. The election-related cases. The number of cases that were reported from the 1st of August to the 4th of August, that is during the specific election number of days. So the total is 129, with the highest being reported in KwaZulu-Natal with 32, in Eastern Cape 17, Free State 16, and the rest of the provinces are listed there. You will also note that out of the 129, 113 of those cases are currently still under investigation. 60 have been referred to court, and a total of 39 suspects have been arrested, with the highest numbers in KwaZulu-Natal and in Northwest. Charges, 1st of February 2016 to 5 August 2016, the type of charges that's been reported in the different provinces. First charge, focusing on making a photographic image or a marked ballot marking photographic image of ballot paper, 2 in Eastern Cape, 3 in the Free State, 4 in KZN, there's a total of 12. The second type, related charges, interfering with the independence or impartiality of the commission, a member, employee or officer of the ISC. That's a total number of cases reported, 10, with the highest numbers in KwaZulu-Natal 4, Mpumalanga 2 and Northwest 2. Removing or concealing voting material, total of 7 cases reported, with 2 in Northwest, 2 in Limpopo, and 1 in Eastern Cape, 1 in KZN, and 1 in Mpumalanga. Continuing with those same type of charges, voting in an election or a voting station while he or she is not entitled to vote in an election, a total number of cases reported is 3, 2 in KZN, and 1 in the Free State. Holding a party meeting on election day or demonstrating of a party, that is 2 cases reported, 1 in KZN and 1 in the Western Cape, and publishing false information with the intent of creating fear to influence candidates, 2 cases reported, 1 in the Western Cape and 1 in the Northwest. So the total number of cases reported over that specific period with reference to the charges that we've highlighted is 36, with the highest number in KZN 12, followed by Northwest with 5 and Free State with 5. Case management, election-related cases, that can be continued with the related charges. In terms of Municipal Electoral Act, it defaced, remove or destroy billboards. A total of 88 cases reported, with the highest number in KZN 18, followed by Eastern Cape and Free State with 14 each, and the Western Cape with 13. Preventing Chief Electoral Officer from gaining access to voters, a total of 7 cases reported, 1 in the Free State, 3 in KZN, and then 111 in Limpopo, Northern Cape, and the Northwest. Interfering with voters' rights to secrecy, 1 case has been reported in KZN. Undue influence, compelling, unlawful persuading of a person to support or not to support any party or a candidate, a total number of 16 cases reported. That is the highest number, Northern Cape is 5, and then we have Eastern Cape and KZN, Northwest with 3, 1, and then Limpopo and Western Cape with 1 case each. contravention of the Electoral Act, a total of one case reported in KZN, and theft of electoral material, a total of two cases, one in Gauteng and one in Mpumalanga. So the total number of cases in specific reference to these type of charges is 115, with the highest numbers recorded in case N 26, followed by Eastern Cape with 70, and then Free State with 15, and Northern Cape with 15. The other type of charges, the arson, public violence, gatherings, reckless negligence, driving, drunk, and driving, a total, you will note there, 149. The detail is available. I just want to highlight the highest numbers. For instance, in public violence, the number of cases, that is from the 1st of February 2016 to the 5th of August. As far as public violence is concerned, is 103 charges. You will note that the highest number is reported in Gauteng, 51, followed by Limpopo with 15 and KZN with 11, and then there are numbers listed there. As far as arson is concerned, just want to highlight the Limpopo province with a total of 27, and that's the national total is 35. The other types of charges are listed there, but the numbers are quite low. Also, we're focusing on charges that relate to common assault, assault, GBAs, robbery, murder, attempted murder, armed robbery, criminal injury, intimidation, etc. On the first slide, I want to highlight intimidation. There's a total of 29 charges, with the highest number reported in KZN province. The second highest we have, assault, GBH, a total of 21 cases reported, with the highest number in Gauteng, that is 8. And then it's followed by murder. A total of 18 cases reported with a total of the highest number of 13 in KwaZulu-Natal, 4 in Gauteng, and 1 in the Eastern Cape. The rest of the cases that refer to theft, burglary, business, theft of motor vehicle, malicious damage to property, the highest is burglary business, a total of 182 reported in Gauteng with a higher number of 178, and then 2 in the Eastern Cape and Western Cape, also 2. And then also malicious damage to property, 110, highest number of 61 in Gauteng, followed by Limpopo with 31. So as far as that, the daily crimes that we monitor on a daily basis are concerned, in this slide and the previous slide, the total number reported is 406, with the highest number being reported in Gauteng province with a total of 272, followed by KZN and Limpopo with 43 each. Then also the other types of cases that relates to fraud, possession of property, possession of unlicensed firearm, dangerous weapons, housebreaking with intent, Firearm Control Act, and the two categories there. The possession of suspected stolen goods, 57, a total of 57, that is also equal to the national total, that's the highest reported rate on the first slide. The rest of the numbers as far as the crimes that I refer to are listed there. The second highest is the possession of unlicensed firearm, 8 incidents with 3 in KZN and 5 in Gauteng province. As far as the Article 27 of the Firearm Control Act is concerned, a total of 5 cases with 3 in KZN, 1 in Eastern Cape and 1 in the Free State. So as far as these two slides are concerned and the number of crimes the crimes that I've referred to, the total is 76. And then the grand total of all the synopsis of all the cases that I've referred to now, the total is 782, with the highest numbers reported in Gauteng with 403, followed by KZN with 101, and Limpopo with 95. In conclusion, over and above the mentioned numbers of hotspots, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo and Gauteng remains the national hotspots, hence more resources were directed to these provinces. The demarcation issues in Limpopo with specific reference to Wulani and the satisfaction with candidate nominees and candidates' killings in KwaZulu-Natal was specifically planned for, and it did not affect the security of the election process. All 22,612 voting stations were open and they were secured during the local government election. And reported cases are being investigated currently in terms of an integrated approach, and the stakeholders involved in that is the South African Police Service, the PCI, and the National Prosecuting Authority. The Department of Justice and Correctional Services was sensitized to prioritize these cases for the 2019 general election, should not have a backlog or outstanding cases that result from what happened in the current 2016 local government process. The deployment of police in terms of this plan, as we indicated previously, did not affect the day-to-day policing that we are responsible for at station level during the election process. And the required budget for the local government elections amounted to 256,968,174. Right. Chair, that concludes my first. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation, General. General McCartney, is there anything you want to add to this presentation?
No, Chair, that's it from our side as far as the election is concerned.
Members, we will go to questions. Remember, we're going to still have the presentations on time intelligence as well as the Botswana, so just our back on those. Yeah, I will start third and then we'll go around the clock. Maybe just to get the sense of the mass appointment of members, officially to the National Commissioner's team. We've seen during the World Cup, Soccer Cup in South Africa, dramatic, let's say, slowdown in crime, active crime. Now, I just want to get the sense, was there during the mass deployment of SAPS members in the 2 to 3 days leading up to the elections and the post-election period also a remarkable downturn in crimes, registered at police stations? I just want to get a sense of that. Then yesterday, and I think it's also your presentation, we took note, committee, of the progress with regard to the killings of councillors and candidates. We think SAS is making good headway there. But we saw comparative figures now from the general in terms of the 2011 and the current figures. I just want to know, in terms of the 2011, we had 80 killings, but also the killing of a councillor in Northern Cape a few days ago. What was the scenario in 2011 in terms of killings? Now, if this is a new phenomenon, if you could take into consideration the 2011 experience, going forward, I see in the conclusion, it's said by the general, that was planning was taken, or the issue of possible violence or killings was taken in consideration. But my question is, if there was no killing of this case in 2011, and we had it now in 2018 or in 2016, what is the planning going forward?
Thank you very much, Jefferson. Let me first start by thanking SAPS for delivering a safe election. We were safe, all safe, because of your hard work. Once more, thank you very much. My third question is, did you encounter any challenges in the execution of your work as planned? My second one, did you have any security breaches in securing voting material? My third one, tell us about the security breach during phase 3 deployment, which is the silent protest during the election results presentations. Or on the 6th of August 2016. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I would like to indicate that I was very much impressed by seeing the men and women in blue in all the voting stations that I have gone through monitoring. Everything was in order and they were always there. I say thank you. In fact, let me not say a lot of things. I just say thank you. So it shows that really you are doing very good. So my next question will be concerning the deployment. I would like to know if ever there was any standard duties allocated deployment, standard deployment to perform their duties, and where did they go to? Where did you deploy them? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presentation. In slide 11, can you please in slide 11, what do you mean with medium high risk situation? My second question, in slide 18, the number of cases of Western Cape is 38, but the number of suspects arrested is 1. I'm confused. Can you please give us clarity for that? And in slide 18 again, what was the cause of the withdrawals in court? Thank you very much.
to Honourable Markey.
Thank you, Jefferson. Just a clarification on page 10. Static protection of voting station. Bullet point number 2. Voting station on 2-4-6 ratio as determined by the threat and risk assessment. Just to understand what that ratio is all about. And then on page 17, the very first bullet point, just to clarify myself, if investigations and monitoring started since the 1st of February, my understanding would be that would be during canvassing or door-to-door and so on, if it's referring to that, because the 1st of February and the 3rd of August, this existence in between, just to clarify that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now, Chairperson, firstly, I'd like to thank members of our police service, really, for very, very outstanding work they did in terms of delivering effective security during the election period. I bear to be a witness to that. I know I've even communicated with some when uprisings were happening in the Mpumalanga province, being here in Cape Town, with an immediate reaction from the police, apprehending those suspects that were involved. I think that was very, very, very good. But my main point here is, with regard to the given stats here, Chairperson, because I am convinced elections, the body that presides over elections is IEBC. I want to find out, in terms of the members executing their duties, Chairperson, what kind of support do you get from IEBC in terms of them enforcing electoral acts as a body charged with responsibility? To do that. I've raised that because, you see, the dumping of voting material that I saw in KZN raised a serious question. When we have been raising a serious question to IEC that the independence of IEC with the usage of these useless statue people is actually threatening free and fair elections in this country, and is eventually going to cause serious political friction. Which, then that is all that I wanted to find out. How much kind of support members of our security get from the IEC in terms of IEC ensuring that they play their role in enforcing the Electoral Act? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, thanks, Chair. Couple of questions from my side. The first one is looking at the figures on slide 19. Slide 19. I'm quite concerned by the figure of the number of cases that were withdrawn in courts, looking at the 2011 cases. Because, I mean, if you look at the guilty verdicts that were attained, that's less than 10% of all the cases that were opened. And I'm just worried about if you're having the vast majority of cases being withdrawn, then that means you've got a very weak deterrence happening in terms of preventing these kind of trends. You know, the only way to have a strong deterrent effect for future crime is to have a high conviction rate, so that's potential criminals know that they've got a high chance of being found and facing the might of the law. So I'm just wanting to get clarity on the column which speaks to the number of withdrawn in court cases. Is who withdrew those cases? Is that complainants withdrawing? Is that the SAS themselves withdrawing the case because they find maybe investigation wasn't quite up scratch, or is that the NPA withdrawing if you find that the case isn't quite watertight? I just need clarity on who is doing that withdrawing, and why, especially if it is one of the state agencies. And even if it is the complainants, I'd be curious to know why so many of those cases are being withdrawn. Because when you open a case that's election-related, it's normally quite a serious affair. So that's my first question, just like I've seen withdrawn in court cases, just some clarity and details on that, please. Okay, and then my second question refers to the figures in slides 25 to 29. And my question there is to ask whether what makes these cases election-related, or is that just the cases in those crime categories that have been captured during that period, which happens to coincide with the run-up to the elections and the election day itself? Because those are all offences that happen all the time. So I'm just curious to know if there's something unique about those cases, or it's just a matter of the time frame within which they were captured. And then my last question relates to slide 31. It's a two-part question. The first is if the SAPS management team could just clarify on what was the role, if any, of the reservists in boosting the ability and the deployment, and what value add might have been attained from that, and possibly any figures you might have on hand as to how many reservist members were called upon to assist. And then secondly, Chair, with that same issue is, if, as the presentation states, that the deployments didn't affect day-to-day policing at station level, I'd just like to know, then, why can't we make what we saw during the elections a permanent situation? The ability was fantastic in my going around in different places. You know, you generally see the sets visible and sort of giving a sort of calming, stabilizing effects on the situation. So if we can make that permanent and to have those kind of conditions that prevent opportunistic crime, then that's the way to go forward. So taking the cue from the point there that it didn't affect day-to-day policing, why can't we make that permanent and benefit from that situation? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. After 20 questions, I don't think there are many questions left. But let me also add my voice to those people thanking and congratulating the police services for an excellent job they did in the old election. I also express my appreciation on Twitter profile and Facebook and everything. I really think that they did a good job. Chairperson, my question is, firstly, I presume that the members will receive their overtime pay because they've worked long hours, and I know in previous elections we had a problem that the people didn't receive their overpay in ample time. So I hope, looking at the budget with the 64 cents worth of it, that at least we will ensure that the people get the remuneration which they need. Chairperson, my second question is also on how do you define election-related cases? Because I see, for instance, we have housebreaking with intent, we have two cases. How do you, can I say, make the definition to say this is housebreaking with intent, which is election-related? It's the same with the 18 murders we had. And my question is then, do we say it's political murders? And we had a discussion yesterday, but I'd like to hear from the acting commissioner. Do we define them then as political murders? And if we do, in what sense do we say that it is a political, I use the word motivated. If it was not political motivated, how did they determine that it is election related? That's my two questions. Thank you.
One more business, welcome. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate you allowing me a question or two. Just on my colleague's question with regards to reservists, the sad part of the election was that a lot of the reservists I came in contact with they weren't working, and I asked them why they weren't working. One of them said, or a few of them said, that there's a firearm competency issue. Now, I asked, what's that for military? And it's really, I mean, they do it 3 times a year or something like that, so it's really just a formality. And unfortunately, that delay caused more than a handful. I mean, the whole of Joburg was rendered, a lot of reservists were rendered useless because of that technicality. On the 2 occasions that I've used the police service in terms of elections, the response was great, and I do appreciate that. In terms of what my colleague over there said, in terms of the IED, the Electoral Act, there's two cases that I can't see, and that's when a person are illegally taken on. I don't see any action, I don't see any arrests that took place there, may have missed it, or maybe there's other detail. Or when a poster is hung illegally, which is on a robot or on an electric substation or any of the sorts, were there any arrests there?
Thank you much. Members, yes, on my job.
Thank you, Chairperson. I forgot to ask something concerning the screening of IEC officials and service providers. I'm asking this question because a day or 3 or 4 after elections, I received a call in my PCO from members who were reporting that in station so-and-so, there was a senior citizen who wanted to vote ANC, and the IEC member crossed on EFF. Now I'm asking myself, how many votes, ANC votes went to EFF or whatever, which other party, being done by the IEC members. That old person, when he arrived at home, he told the grandchild that he was worried because of what happened. They went back to the voting station, and the IEC there, they admitted the mistake and he was made to fill in another form. But then, what about the other form that was wrongly indicated? And this is I'm not saying the elections were not free and fair. I just want to be clarified on how the screening was done. It was part of checking neutrality of IEC that something like that. I just want to use my reasoning power. Thank you.
Chairperson, I'm checked. I think there are some votes who were meant for the Freedom from Club, but he went to the AIA.
Thank you, Chairperson. Any other
members?
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and we appreciate the compliments for the work done by police. Chair, on the mass deployment over the election period, not only on the election day, but even during the days of registration, where the numbers were increased, and they will certainly have had an impact on the incidence of crime because of the visibility and the fact that you have many people focused on one thing, which is getting to the voting station. There is an impact as far as the reporting of crime over that period is concerned. I think, Chair, later on when we communicate our stance, we will make that visible, particularly when you do a comparative analysis from one quarter to the other, because in the quarter during which period the elections were, you will find that certain categories of crimes are on the decline. So it certainly has an impact. Honourable Chair, in respect of the killings, which was unfortunate, and we regret that during a period like this, we experience these unfortunate killings. Not that it is acceptable, for people to be killed at any time, but here it was more related to either the candidature of the person is being nominated, and you find them being taken out of the equation. We would not have known that so-and-so is going to be killed, but you obviously would have had a sense that in this area the temperature is not on the right level from a complete perspective, and that would have been informed our response in a number of situations. We obviously do not expect this to be a forever thing. We will continue to intensify our efforts from an intelligence gathering perspective, so that those that are involved are brought to book. We are happy with the progress, as the Honorable Chair noted, in as far as the killings, where a number of arrests have been effected, and we believe that the conviction of those that are responsible should serve as a deterrent going forward. Honorable Mulevati's question on challenges in the execution of our work, Honorable Te, I must say that we had a different plan. We had the pre-election plan, we had the during the election phase plan, and we had the post-election, and in our view the plan was well executed, and that's why we could give confidence saying that we will deliver a safe and secure election, and I'm just grateful for the response of our members in sticking to the plans and make sure that we allow South Africans to cast their votes. We also, this was not only us as the police, as we indicated, it's a plan that flows out of the net joints where all other departments, particularly departments in the security cluster, are involved, and the cooperation, the sharing of resources went a long way in ensuring that we deliver on this one. So there were no disruptions as far as our plans are concerned. 5 P's applies. Proper preparation prevents poor performance, and I thought that that was a reality. Honorable Chair, in terms of the security breaches, in as far as election material is concerned, yes, there were some incidents. I think some would have been made visible here. But Chair will recall there was an incident in Soweto where the election material was being transported, and a truck transporting the election material was hijacked, and I think some ballot boxes were taken, which were ultimately recovered, but also were destroyed by the IEC in terms of their processes and ensure that those material were replaced. That vehicle, I will call it a security breach, because our commitment was to transport material, to escort those vehicles that are transporting IEC material to the warehouses, from the warehouses to the voting station. That particular incident, not the Metro Police, not the South African Police, was involved, and we know that the IEC had to act following that incident, because it was not according to the expectation, and that's why we experienced that unfortunate incident. But I think we worked together well with the IEC to keep the recurrence of such. In terms of what happened, Chair, at the IEC The Rock on the final day, it was so spontaneous. There's a commitment we made to look into the details and to find ways of not having the recurrence of such. Everyone has got a democratic right to to voice their issues, but I think if people were a little clearer and not operating under a pretext, this would have been difficult. So, Chair, may I request not to talk too much to the details of this particular matter. Safe to say that it is something that we have observed. It is unfortunate, and we will continue to work hard to deal with matters of this nature. Honourable Madija, in respect of the SNDF, the SNDF were primarily providing logistical support. We, for example, have the Oryx helicopters to be able to do air patrol, to be able to monitor the situation moving from one point to the other, I think it is very much appreciated that we could work together in that way, together with the SNDF, because they really became a force multiplier. Another area where the SNDF was involved, particularly in the areas where we had some challenges, one is another one, they were available to deploy the tents. For example, you go to a voting station. For example, that station is a school, and you find the premises is locked, and the IEC will not have had tents on standby. So for the purposes of ensuring that the people are allowed to vote, in such instances, we do mobilization, they will erect the tents, and the IEC personnel will be able to function from there and allow the people to vote. So the role of the SNDF during this process was primarily election. We did not have boots on the ground. Of course, they would have been on standby if the situation were to be beyond control. We were obviously through the necessary processes going to activate them. The issue, Honourable Manager, on the screening of the IEC personnel, it's a function that is being performed by state security in clearing those that are going to be playing a part either as presiding officers or whatever. I am not privy to the details as to what that screening entails, but it is part and parcel of our plan, because this is not solely a subs plan. It is our plan as the mayor joins and as to who is playing what role in ensuring that the election process runs smooth. Honourable Muller, on the medium, I think you raised the issue around slide 11, low, medium, and high risk. Where we will have, I think we made it visible here, the figures in terms of what we termed hotspots. So we would have taken a province informed by intelligence and assessment that is done to say how volatile is that particular area. And we will have made a determination that in this particular area we do not expect any challenges. As the general was going through, I think it is the slide 11, we mentioned, for example, the voting stations, which we consider to be high risk. I think we ended up with a total of 650 that were high risk. So, from an operational perspective, that high risk informs the deployment. That deployment are people that will be static. And those that are static, you will have noted that low risk, we have two people. If it is medium, it is four. If it is a high risk, we have six. But that will not be the only people deployed in that particular area, because we have got the roving teams. In other words, to be able to do perimeter patrol and make sure that the order is maintained. So it's more for operational reasons that we will categorize the station as low, medium, and high risk. At some point, the Honorable Chair felt that some of those stations which we consider to be high risk became low risk on the day of the election, because as you were moving around, you did not get a sense that there was anything that was going to happen. And for that, we will always be grateful to the South Africans who are law-abiding. On slide number 18, Honorable Muller, where the issue of 38, I think you said 38 cases, only one arrest. Yes, that would have been the case. It is only following further investigation that those responsible will be brought to book. Honorable Chair, the question raised by Honorable Martin, the one on slide 10, the 2-4-6 ratio, simply talks to if we had it has a relationship with the risk level of the voting district. As we said, if you have a low risk voting station, we only assign 2 people. If it is a medium risk, it is 4 people. If it is high risk, 6 people. And I think this figures, Honorable Chair, we are communicating them for the first time, because we cannot afford to have such communicated before or during deployment, because people may take advantage of such. We are communicating now because I think it's post the election. So you can't then mobilize to have people protest at a low risk, because it's irrelevant now. On slide 17, Honorable Marke raised an issue about the 1st of February. Honorable Chair, you will recall that we always talk about the pre-election phase, during the elections, as well as post. So this period will include the registration, during the registration process, because we have those weekends where, or days that were set for people to register. The figures that we are factoring in here also included that particular period. It is not only talking to the period between the 1st of August and the 4th of August. That is why you will read what we have said, which we say we investigated and monitored since the 1st of February. So if there was a case coming out of the registration process, it was to be investigated, and we continue with monitoring there of as part of the LGE process. Honorable Mfongo, we do work with the IEC very closely, Chair. I think in the initial slides we did make visible who are the role players that were on board during the training process and also the election process. The elections remains a mandate of the IEC, and therefore our mandate as the police is to ensure the security, securing the elections, and we do that in collaboration with the IEC. In as far as the Electoral Act is concerned, you have the commission and the related structures dictated by the Electoral Act that deals with a certain category of election-related transgressions. And we will deal with those that crime-related. So there is a very close working relationship, referrals and so on. If it is not a matter which is within the competency of the IEC, it will then be referred to the police, and we will deal with it if it is within our mandate. And they continue to work questions raised by Honorable Mbele. The ones on slide 19 relating to the 423 cases. If a matter is withdrawn in court, it was not withdrawn by the police. It would have been withdrawn by the presiding officer. The police would have done what they were supposed to do in doing the investigation, preparing the case for court, having the case presented there, and the withdrawal will take place there. It is also not the complainant who will then do a withdrawal. It is a withdrawal within the competency of the court, informed by whatever. I am not in a position now to do a breakdown as to what were the reasons at hand that informed the withdrawal of such cases. Safe to say that we would have done the work that we are supposed to do as the South African police service and presented the case before the court, and on merit a decision would have been taken, and we continue to respect the outcomes of courts, and this is one such instance. Honorable Chair, matters between slide number 25 to 29, what makes them election related. You will not have had, for example, I know Honorable Mulevati, you will know the area I'm talking of, Central City, invaded in the manner that it was invaded, if it had nothing to do with the protest related to the candidates and so on. It is in such instances that we will draw them closer to the election. Of course, I think amongst the Honorable Kulevas would have mentioned, you will not have a category or a definition of a crime which is called election-related crime, or what is it, a political motivated crime. We more informed by the situation, the circumstances, we will say what would have triggered this particular instance. So for the purposes of taking account of what's happening, we'll then have categorized them as such, just for reporting purposes. It will not mean that during the entire election process, for example, the matters that we have made visible are the only matters that were committed. There would have been more committed, but these ones, the situation, the circumstances suggest that it has a direct relation to the election process. If you take, for example, the vandalization that was taking place around Tshwane, whether you go to Mamelodi, whether you go Ashesville, under normal circumstances, we will not have had such. That's why we draw them and make them visible here as election related. But somewhere when we communicate ourselves, you are not going to find a category which is a election-related matters, because those are matters. If it is urgent, it is urgent. It is just so that this is the process that we were focused on monitoring and managing. Honorable Bene, on slide 31, and the question is, why not a permanent arrangement? With a process like the elections, we do extraordinary things. For example, some of the members that are being utilized or deployed during this process are people who are based at national headquarters doing certain functions there, at provincial headquarters performing certain functions there. You have people who, under normal circumstances, would have been on rest days because the Labor Relations Act dictates the number of hours a person must work a day or during a week or so. So, and it has got relation with what Honorable Groenewald was mentioning. He mentioned overtime. So we will draw those people from their rest days. People will not ordinarily be on leave. So we deploy to make sure that we have got enough to secure that process, because the election is not a forever process. So that's why you will be able to find this number that we were able to deploy at any given time. But we will not be able to afford it at the rate that we have done deployment. The 256 million, for example, is money that is not additional to our budget. We had to find it within our baseline, and particularly because it's pressure demanding on resources and so on, that we were able. But having said that, Honorable Chair, we are on record as having said that the policing will be characterized by visibility. We continue to do that, and we are happy with the progress that we're making in the fight against crime. The issue raised by Honorable Groenewald on overtime, the members will be paid overtime. It was provided for. We had engagement with labor in this regard. We do not expect any problems in this instance. I think Honorable Groenewald, I in a way have dealt with the question on what makes it election related and how do you define it. So I'm simply saying it is the circumstances, the situation that we find ourselves in, the characteristics of such, and it is being dealt with in that way. I unfortunately could not capture the surname of the Honourable Member who spoke last.
Bergman.
Okay. Honourable Bergman, the issue of reservists, in the deployment that we have made visible here, the reservists are included. And we did not need the services of all the reservists. It is what was our plan, where did we have need. So certainly, the issue of firearm competencies will not have been an impediment in as far as this election is concerned, because those that are competent were deployed. The numbers that we have deployed of the reservists during this process is 5,528 countrywide. But having said that, I think we will continue to work on compliance in as far as the firearm competency is concerned. This is not only applicable to reservists, it also affects the permanent members. There is a program that is dealing with such. Honorable Chair, I'm not able to say much in respect of the posters illegally taken down and so on, because I don't have the specifics. But if that was an incident that was reported, it would have been part of our submission. I thought I covered all, Chair. Thank you very much.
Maybe I see a few answers, but I think let's just get the intelligence briefing, and then we can also deal with your follow-ups, because I think there's a lot of two or three questions already touched on that. So if we can just get the role of crime intelligence, because there was, of course, questions in the public domain, also from members with regard to the response regarding Guyani, Tuane as well, and that we just get a sense what was the planning, what was the steps taken. So thank you very much, General.
Thanks. Thanks, Honorable Chair. General Ravi is going to run the presentation.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Committee, the next presentation will focus on the role of crime intelligence in the detection of crime and unrest during this election process. And as you indicated, there was a need to identify, to focus on specific areas where we identify problems during the election process. So we're going to focus specifically on Tshwane, KwaZulu-Natal, the suspected political related killings, the Wuwani unrest, and then we will follow a more general approach in terms of how crime intelligence was deployed and utilized during the election process, the forums that were applicable, the focus of crime intelligence, the screening of officials, and the approach followed to identify the relevant hotspots. Now, starting first with the Tshwane unrest, it started with the unconfirmed information at that time that was received regarding possible disruptive actions in Tshwane area related to the nomination of ANC mayoral candidates. Now, you will note that we refer there to unconfirmed because all intelligence information needs first to be confirmed And then in view of that, the information that he received, the relevant sources were tasked and information was disseminated to operational divisions for operationalization. When information received indicated that the situation was deteriorating, the National Crime Intelligence Operational Center was activated on a 24/7 basis, in specifically in Pretoria. The collection capabilities that we have within Gauteng province was redirected. They redirected their current source networks to obtain information regarding the unrest situation in Tshwane. This also included the collection capacities from the national head office that were deployed to enhance ground coverage and to recruit new or specific sources to further enhance the intelligence picture that was available at the time on the situation in Tshwane. Where proactive information was received, it was immediately disseminated to operational divisions and other law enforcement agencies for law enforcement purposes. The analysts involved in this exercise during the Tshwane unrest managed to identify and profile several instigators responsible for mobilizing unrest actions. These profiles were forwarded to the detective service within SAPS as well as the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigations. Out of the profiles provided to the DPCI, four suspects were identified to be responsible for the overturning of a Metro Police vehicle in Arcadia, and these cases are currently with the DPP for decision, and it's investigated by the DPCI. Other information provided by crime intelligence led to the arrest of several suspects involved in the looting, theft, arson during the period where we identify or we experienced the unrest in Tshwane. Moving to the situation in KwaZulu-Natal, with specific reference to the suspected political-related killings, first of all, a provincial task team was established to investigate the suspected political-related murders in KwaZulu-Natal. Our crime intelligence itself is represented on this task team with the mandate to collect and analyze information on possible suspects responsible for these murders. In the run-up to the actions, the dedicated intelligence collector from head office were also deployed to the identified hotspots in KwaZulu-Natal, and the main purpose of this deployment was to assist the provincial intelligence collectors with the identification of possible instigators on other emerging threats. These collectors were deployed 7 days prior to the actual election to enhance provincial intelligence capabilities in our specific identified hotspot areas, and where proactive information was received on these specific threats, it was immediately disseminated to our relevant operational divisions. With reference to the political or the situation in Vuwani, the under situation where several schools were burned down, following the initial violence in Vuwani area, crime intelligence task team was established to identify instigators that was responsible and can link to the root causes of the violent protest. The information was liaised with the detective service, who effected several arrests of the identified instigators. The dedicated intelligence collectors are currently gathering information on an ongoing basis to ensure that all suspects and instigators are identified and monitored and neutralized. In the run-up to the elections, the dedicated crime intelligence command center was established in Malamulele to monitor the security situation prior to the election, during the election, and immediately after the election phases. The dedicated intelligence collectors from the head office were also deployed within identified hotspot areas, the same principle as what we applied in KwaZulu-Natal 7 days prior to the actual elections to enhance the intelligence collection capability that we had available in that specific province. 5 instigators who attempted to influence and intimidate residents not to vote were identified, and this was handed over to investigators for the necessary investigation. Now that, Honourable Chair, refers to the specific areas, Vuwani, the KZN and the Tshwane incidents. As far as the local government election process generally is concerned, the main objective of the Division of Crime Intelligence during the elections was to generate and provide timeless, credible, accurate, and actionable intelligence to operational clients, to inform our planning processes, to inform our deployment processes during the pre-election process as well as during and immediately after elections. For this purpose, intelligence was gathered to warn, inform, predict, and advise on stability issues, and then also to identify specific areas where we could have possible disruptions or incidents of unrest. To achieve this purpose, CA maintained a focused and dedicated intelligence capability that was deployed in all our provinces, especially within the high-risk and identified hotspot areas.
Now, in terms of the operational focus areas that's been identified by gun intelligence during the election process, primarily there was two primary areas. The first one relates to crime around your polling areas, terrorism, domestic extremism, electioneering, intimidation, removal, destroying of placards, disruption of political meetings, gatherings, the so-called no-go zones, disruptive protest events, intra and inter-party political contestation, fraud, municipal border demarcation disputes, anti-foreigner sentiments, labor unrest, taxi violence, illegal activities of social movements, illegal occupation of land, border integrity, and possible impact of protest action at institutions of higher learning. Now, continuing with the focus of crime intelligence, firstly, crime intelligence capacities throughout the election period were responsible for the following: identification and recruitment of intelligence resources to generate and provide relevant information on identified threats. That includes your instigators that we previously referred to. The identification of hotspot areas to inform deployments. To establish sufficient ground covers for the provision of early warning intelligence for operational clients and to conducting intelligence operations. Joint operations were also conducted with operational divisions during the election process, and also that includes our identified hotspot areas and where is possible threat were identified. The National Provincial Operational Centers of Crime Intelligence were activated from the 29th of July until the 5th of August, and they operated on a 24/7 basis. And the function of these operational centers included the following: the profiling of instigators, doing threat assessments, the daily stability reports, social media monitoring, open source monitoring, and screening of ISE service providers. Products were provided to clients, such as the Acting National Commissioner, Provincial Commissioners, Operational Divisional Commissioners, the NATJOG, DECOG, the Crime Intelligence, and ORS Provincial Heads, and then also our POP, or Public Order Police Unit Commanders in our provinces. Crime Intelligence was represented at the following forums dealing with issues that related directly with the 2016 local government elections: the ECOG Task Team on the 2016 local government elections, the Interdepartmental Intelligence Coordinating Committees at national and provincial level, and in that joins that includes the Election Priority Committee that was established at that level. Information that was generated on a day-to-day basis was included in the interdepartmental products, and those products were provided to those forums or structures mentioned above on a continuous basis. The screening of IEC officials, risk rating, as well as the risk rating of polling stations. Crime Intelligence assisted in the screening of IEC officials or contracted staff. Now that includes the presiding and deputy presiding officers and service providers. Conducted the risk ratings of all the polling stations, 22,612 of them. Now, the purpose of that was to ensure, as we previously referred to guide the deployment of personnel according to the risk rating, as General Pasani referred to the low, medium, and risk areas, taking into consideration areas affected during the voter registration weekends, as well as where there was incidents of violence or instability during or prior to the elections. This process was ongoing as the situation fluctuated during the electioneering process. General Masami referred to on a continuous basis the risk rating of these could change as a result of incidents that were identified or came to a stop at specific points. The aim of the Crime Intelligence Division was to focus on hotspot areas during the election process, the pre-election and post-election phases, to ensure that we have optimal deployment of personnel, and then the deployment also took place in terms of the operational demand. The total number of 270 hotspots were identified, and that included the following: in the Eastern Cape, there were two of them, Mount Aleph and King Williamstown. In Gauteng, included Atteridgeville, Mamelodi, Amanskraal, Olifantsbos, Tshepisong, Hanspruit, Lenasia, Mabopane, and Soshanguve, total of 9. KwaZulu-Natal, Fourweni, I believe that must be Cleveland's and not Cleveland's, Cleveland's and Kwamashu hostels, Umlazi, Mandeni, Wembedi in Escort and Mangoma, Wuwani in Limpopo, Bushbakrishi in Mpumalanga, Marikana in Northwest, Kailisha, Masupelele in Western Cape, as well as Nyanga. And thank you, that concludes my presentation on the involvement of crime intelligence. Thank you, sir.
Very much, members. We will now go to questions as well as follow-ups. Honourable Groenewald, I saw you will be first, then Honourable Molebasi. Maybe just the first question from my side. I just want to know, in terms of experience flowing from the Limpopo incidents and Tshwane, I think we take note of the interventions, the head office interventions, but is the current system again of deployment at cluster level and the number of informants attached to that work in the current model? I mean, we know that crime intelligence went through a very tough period, and I think there's a move now to stability, and the Major General is doing good work in terms of the presentation we got earlier this year. But the question is, because we as a portfolio collective must have assurance that if there is any threat to the state or threat to the stability, that there is early deterrence, there's early detection. Now, is the cluster system working? Although, I mean, years ago, we had a presentation, it was implemented by the Kruger model. Now, isn't sufficient. I don't even want to refer to the incident as a rock, but are we doing actually early detection analysis and also, ensuring that we've got the necessary responses? Because some of the incidents, I think, where your police station do not react immediately, then you must bring in the specialized units. I just want to get assurance that we're looking at that model. Honourable
Malabasi. Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask a follow-up on the definition of political motivated, whatever you may call it, murder, because there was a bit of confusion in the media at one stage, because the media referred to political murders. And then there was some reaction from, even from the side, from the minister, that said, no, but it's not political motivated. So, I presume then, if I've listened to what the commissioner has said, that we can talk about the suspected political murders. I suppose that we will have to determine the real motive. My problem is we never hear in the end what the real motive was, so it will be good if we get the feedback at some stage to say, yes, it was really politically motivated. Chairperson, my question is, I'd like to know what's the cooperation with the state security agencies, specifically when you talk about the unrest in Tshwane and all the other hotspots. These are crime intelligence. Were there good cooperation with and from, especially from SSA, in the whole intelligence-driven operations? My last question, Chairperson, the illegal occupation of land. What is the situation of SAPS when it comes to the illegal occupation of land? Because we have situation. But then if you go to the police, then they say, yeah, but you have to come with a court order before we can react. Which I don't think is correct, because if people are illegal on your property and you ask the police to act, then they should act, because it's illegal occupation. Okay, we can go on the definition of occupation, but I'd like to hear from the commissioner, what are the requirements before the police will react on charges of occupation of land? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Apart from the issue of the nomination of the MC mayoral candidate in Tshwane, did you maybe find some other influencing factors, or to be more direct, a third force involved, because we are in election mode? Thank you.
No, you must ask your...
Thank you, Chairperson. During this election process, there was this thing of a character assassination because other people were reporting wrong information. So I want to know, what does the crime intelligence do about that? Thank you.
Concerning the Tshwane issue, I just want to know, on page 7, it is indicated that 5 investigators were identified and information submitted to investigators. The question is, are they arrested? And to top up a question, the last school in Vuane was not so good because the communities were so shocked. But then how far is the process of arresting those people? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jay. Just one question from my side, and it links to the question you raised about the state and the efficacy of crime intelligence on the ground with respect to informants. Because I was a bit concerned looking on slide 10 that the first bullet point was giving the action steps as identification and recruitment of intelligence sources. I mean, ideally those should already have been in place and should always be in place, and not be part of a last-minute scramble once a crisis erupts. Because my main concern, especially with the Swanee unrest, was the unabated escalation that happened for the first 24 to 36 hours, which means that the readiness and the preparation really just wasn't there in the first place. So my question relates to the hotspots outlined towards the end of the presentation. Were there any of those hotspots in which crime intelligence does not have paid informants? Because that would speak to a big gap and means that we're just not in this condition to optimally deal with the situation. So are there any gaps or vacuums, especially in those identified hotspots, where you don't have to say which ones, but just are there any of them where we have a problem with not having any informants on the ground? Because that means we don't have eyes and ears watching us for trends, emerging profiles or whatever the case might be, to foresee any potential problems. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jefferson. You made mention of four suspects which were identified for turning the Metropolis vehicle. My question is, what happened to them? Where are they? Yes, sir.
So I maybe want to also, again, the issue of reaction time, and especially at the rural stations during the unrest in Limpopo and other hotspots, because that's a major issue. Was there any study done by SAPS, maybe a research unit or crime intelligence, to look at the reaction time in terms of when, for instance, an incident is occurring? And then I received a letter from chairperson of the Education Committee. You must not discuss that manco, but yeah, he's asking for a joint meeting. Now, it's got to do with the issue also of a timeless action from the police at the university campuses in terms of calling up on the incident that happened there. I think it was a recent report that there was no arrests in terms of the infrastructure deployment at some of the campuses. So I just want to know, in terms of going forward, whether there is a proactive plan from crime intelligence to ensure that actions to destroy places of higher education, schools, infrastructure, that there is a specific effort to target that, and the necessary recruitment is done to ensure that there is stability. I just want to get a sense of that as well. Any other questions on this presentation, members? Thank you. General, you're welcome.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. At times on the intelligence environment, one must always appreciate that I can't go too far because I'll be giving too much away, which in itself will be counterproductive. So when I'm responding to these questions, Chair, bear with me. If somewhere you feel like I'm a little bit evasive, I hope that there is an understanding.
Yes, sir.
please, we don't want any classified information to be made available to this committee, but the principle, and I mean the management principle, I think the previous problems in that environment was the management and also at station plus the provincial level. I mean, that is the real issue. If there's close management and monitoring, and I mean, that's where the issue of your new unit that headed by General Cruz also comes in. You know, is there the lessons, because that's what the committee is really looking for this morning, the lessons of Limpopo, the lessons of Tshwane, are we going to take those lessons and maybe adjust our strategy and tactics? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I think as a start, this challenge may inform why, as a department, we, in the review of our structures, arrived at the conclusion of separating crime intelligence and counterintelligence. That we are now having, we are now in process of establishing that dedicated counterintelligence capacity to be able to deal comprehensively with the issues. We are, of course, still at the initiation stage. I think we are much more closer in terms of fully capacitating the crime intelligence environment, including the cluster, Honorable Chair, that you have spoken to, because we are saying that intelligence is there at local level. Here at the higher level, you do collation and verification, but you need to piece things together there where it is happening most. But we are confident that good progress is being made in that regard. I think to some extent, I'm also trying to deal with the question you raised on the system of deployment. Yes, we still are following the cluster approach. We may not have reach the maximum level of deployment in terms of appointing people and so on. So we can only, once we have fully capacitated, be able to say whether it is working or not. But for now, I think it is making business sense, considering that the intelligence structure at cluster level is also a feeder into the cluster structure. From an operational policy perspective, and it is compelling the two to work together, because for you to realize operations, you can't do that uninformed. You need to know what is it that is prevailing in this community that are in policy, what are the issues, and your interventions must be responsive, while responding is not the only thing that we are supposed to be doing, because we need to be very, very proactive and it should be informed by those interventions. In terms of maybe the issue that the Honorable Chair has raised on reaction time, it's an issue. We always argue with our CI colleagues and state security to say, maybe some of these things we should receive it much earlier, so that we don't have an explosion or an implosion in our face. If you take, for example, what happened in Tshwane, I never expected Tshwane to be like that, but it happened. We had to move swiftly, and I was happy that we were able to bring the situation under control within shorter time frames. But we will learn from those experiences, Honorable Chair, including what happened in Vuani. I mean, let's agree, it's unacceptable to get to a situation where 24 schools are banned, in a very short space of time. Now, what was evident in the Vuani experience was that people were not moving as groups, which meant there was a smaller group responsible for planning and resourcing people to be able to do what they did. They were, for example, fed with drugs, amongst others, alcohol. There was a supply of petrol for the petrol bombs and so on. And he really took advantage of the poor people, using them while actually the big fishes are somewhere there in the background. And we were happy when we got to the point where arrests were effected. We continue to be on their tracks to make sure that we bring them to book. Honorable Chair will recall you had the schools burning. At some point we arrested these people. They were detained for long. Cases were being postponed. Unfortunately, at some point they were granted bail, and we went back to square one. When they were in detention, the situation was under control. Release, we had issues. They were making, as you recall, irresponsible statements, intimidating people, and so on. And we could not be spectators in that situation. So somewhere we had to take a decision of effecting arrest, which again brought the situation to normality. And that is, amongst others, what helped us to manage the Bwane situation by taking those key people that were responsible for this out of the community and have them detained. Elections, we deployed. I mean, unlike in the test registration process, where very few voting stations could be opened. Second, I think the number increased. And in the election, we had all stations operational. Elections passed. I think the first Monday after the elections, those people were released, again granted bail. Same evening, a school went burning. And at that time, the community was working on ensuring the cleaning of the schools and so on. So the feedback, it came as a shock even to the community, as Honorable Magida is saying. So we do what we can do, Chen, but there are certain things that we are not in control of. There are decisions that are taken which unfortunately impact on the work that we are doing. It is on that background, Chen, that somewhere I said, it can't be that everything that we do is attributed to the absence or the availability of intelligence. There are many other factors that come into the equation in situations like these. But we'll continue to do our best in managing the situation. But we are confident that we have established ourselves a crime intelligence. It's not an environment without challenges. There continues to be challenges, but I think where we are sitting, we are managing these issues to the best of our abilities. And CTO.
Generally speak of arresting smaller fishes. Does this arresting of smaller fishes lead you to arresting the bigger fishes? And if it does, do you do it? Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Chair, thanks. If one will arrest the big fishes, it is the big fishes that were detained and they ultimately were released, but it is those people that are utilizing other people, because you arrest a stone thrower here, you don't find a justification to have the person kept behind bars for longer. That is why our focus was now on those that are in the leadership group that are responsible for this. The way identified, we continue to get them behind bars, but when matters appear before court, it's something that the decisions are taken, and we have to respect those decisions. Honorable Khunyavat, I think I'm with you on the issue of motive. As I said, you will not find a categorization anywhere on our system. It's more what would have been the motive. And yes, at some point there will be pronouncements, I guess, at a point where these matters are before the court as to what exactly was the issue there. So I appreciate that understanding. State security, Honorable Chair, there is very close working relationship between us and state security, in particular between crime intelligence and the intelligence community, the sharing of the information. In the planning that we are doing, we rely heavily on those multiple sources, the structures within the intelligence community working together. If you follow the developments during the election, we always have been moving around together with the DG State Security because it's an internet interests us all, and we do get the cooperation information coming. Like if you go to this source, you need to have a verification. So that's the basis on which we will say that's what we must be going. We're going for. I am deliberately going to leave the question on the illegal occupation for last because I will want my operational colleagues to talk to it. And if you don't mind, Honorable Khulimar, we'll come back to it. Maybe it's between General Masamo and General Mawela, they will deal with this issue. Theft force, Honorable Malevati, I can't publicly say yes, but this matter did not only have to do with the nomination of mayor. We have found that a criminality was a dominant factor in there. We cannot only attribute what happened in Swaziland to that. In the process, you had violence on the one side, you had the land invasion on the other. So it was really a number of issues that came in the mix. And to prove that it was not only an ANC matter, we today still have issues in Mamelodi. I think this week there were issues relating to land invasions, relating to the unlawful occupation of houses in there. So this all, you can't attribute it to one. It so happens that people may have taken advantage of a situation and benefit in that case. The fourth aspect that we have referred to, Honorable Malevati, relating to the Metro Police Car, we said the case is before the Director of Public Prosecutions to make a decision. Once a decision is made as to go we are prosecuting, as the people are known, we will go and connect them, and they will be processed through the courts. The issues, Honorable Chair, by Honorable Mula, on character assassination, ordinarily we will deal with this if there is an element of intimidation and so on. If there is, for example, issues relating to criminal injury, we then expect those that are on the receiving end to approach the police so that we could open cases and deal with the perpetrators of such. And I think crime intelligence will continue to play the role that they play. For example, what is it that these people are saying, and what reaction is it to generate from the masses on the ground so that it can be dealt with accordingly. In a way, I have answered Honorable Marija's question on the instigators. Were they arrested? Yes. As we said, we have been arresting them, getting them to court. Some of them, the cases, I think, were postponed several times, released, arrested again. But we are continuing to monitor those specific individuals. If anything unlawful is being done, we won't hesitate to act because that will be an injustice. Honorable Bennett's questions, Honorable Chair, I'll answer this question safely by saying that we have ground coverage from an intelligence perspective. I am not going to say whether paid or not paid, but the informers are there, they're employed. We continue to do the recruitment. The recruitment we said in here is there are non-issues which become an issue at the time, which requires infiltration. So at that point, we will then go into it. For long, if I just use an example, we did not have an issue in the institutions of learning. Not that you did not have sources in that environment, but a new trend developed, which now forces us to redirect our focus into that threat which is emerging, and also the change in the role players informs the redirection of the resources from an intelligence perspective to make sure that we get what we require to be able to deal with the situation. Maybe Honorable Chair, a question that you raised, I think you referred to the report on the institutions of higher learning. I so wish that some of these things could be dealt with by the relevant authorities before it becomes a policing problem. Because many of these, take for example the security of the institutions of learning. It is the responsibility of the institution in terms of the deployment of the security and so on. But the situation escalates to that level where we have to go in. But the issue that relates, that informs that situation from escalating to that level, could have been dealt with by the relevant authorities. Now, who remains with these pains of the bad guy, the policeman and the policewoman who goes in there? Because unfortunately, we can't be spectators when there is no lawlessness. We continue to interact with the DG, the minister in that space, but also the institutions. And from our side, we have been talking of intensifying our efforts in terms of deployment, not only at a visible policy level, but also from an intelligence gathering perspective, for us not to be surprised by situations of this nature. May I, with your permission, ask General Mawena, General Matemula, to deal with Honorable Khunava's land invasion related question?
Give them 10 minutes preparation time. We're going to take 3 or 10 minutes, and then we'll come back to the responses, and we'll also try to show any presentation and other. Thank you. 10 minutes. Right, thank you very much, Honourable Members. We're going to continue with our proceedings. We're going to go to the responses. That's still outstanding. Then we will deal also with the Tshwane audit, and then also get a briefing on new appointment that was made by SAPS since 1 April on levels 15 and 14 in terms of the new management team. So we'll also allow SAPS that we're not here with that question. So I don't know, General, over to you, General Bahane.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. With regard to the question of Honorable Khunava of what is the status with regard to the issue of land occupation. As soon as there is any land occupation, as SAPS, what we do, the owner normally will report the matter and open a case of trespass. And we will immediately respond, assist in clearing the site of the land wherever they are. But if the occupation has been there for more than 48 hours, then another legislation can come into force. So there's also a problem between, sometimes you find on land, private land, there is quicker response, but on state land, sometimes the response by the owners takes a bit time, which complicates the matter. But I must also say, I'm aware that on the ground, we do have problems somewhere, not all, but in certain areas with our police on the ground in the implementation of this, which I'm saying. There has been directives in the past. But last week, myself and General Masiyo, we had a meeting with stakeholders around the issue, and we did pick up that there is misunderstanding by our members on the ground. So as a result, we are busy drawing up a directive which will send to the various provinces for implementation. We are aware that the standard of implementation, currently there are areas of concern that we are addressing the questions.
Thank you very much. So,
thank you. I think it is important to note, Honourable Hunewald, that people must lodge, we call it a trespass, it's a trespass case, because we lodge with the police. But that must be as in immediate. If those people have occupied the place longer than the 48 hours, it becomes a separate process that must be dealt with. At that point, I think the police can cue from all other role players. But within the first 48 hours, immediately the owner approaches the police station, lodges a trespass complaint, and it is expected of our members to act. Where, for example, there is a deviation, we would want to deal with it. That is why General Masemuna is talking about the directives. But what we will do in addition, we just established a crime prevention awareness directory, which has got responsibility to do awareness and community education. So I think it is an issue that we must not only communicate within our structures, but an issue that we must raise with the community broadly so that they know what the implications are. Why we make reference to the 48-hour period? Once they are therefore over the 48-hour period, that thing of the provision of alternative accommodation then comes into place. Now, we will not be able to provide alternative accommodation because we are not the owner. So, Chair, I thought I must just clarify that part.
And Arnold Bergman?
No, thank you, Jefferson. The general answer, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you. But I appreciate that they get the basis up to ground level with police stations because we have a problem. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Arnold Bergman?
Thanks. Yeah, just with regards to the previous response on the Fed Force, this was a bit wishy-washy, and I can understand the vagueness, but what we do need ruled out, because it could possibly be brought up in Parliament for adults and people which could be irresponsible. Either we know what's behind it in our investigation, or we have strong suspicion, or we don't. If we don't, we should say we don't know. If we do, though, can we rule out other political parties in this? I'm comfortable with the fact that there might be a criminal element and not just the party element, but if there's another party involved, I would like that either ruled out or substantiated.
Thank you. Members, any other questions on this issue? We will, of course, give ample opportunity when we dealt with other two presentations. General, are you?
Okay, do we go to the presentation or do we deal with the issue raised?
Want to know?
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe just in passing, Chair, or in response, let me not just pass it. It's an issue that is raised by the Honourable Member. In our response, we don't make reference to any party, Chair. It is an issue that we say we are aware that criminality may have played a part. As to who those people are, where they belong, it's something that only once we pin them down we'll be able to know. But I can't link parties to matters of criminality. It is important that we be allowed space to investigate. That's why I can't conclusively come here and say there's a task force. But I also can't come to Parliament and say I don't know. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to allow General Ravi to deal with the matter relating to Swane Anders.
General
Robin, thank you. Thank you. The next presentation will focus specifically on the Swane unrest, and you will know that we are starting to duplicate certain things because it's linked to the previous two presentations as well. Now, during this presentation, we're just going to focus on the areas that have been affected by the specific incidents, the operational concept that was adopted, the coordinating structures that were established, the deployment, the focus areas, the types of interventions, and it's also important for us just to highlight to the committee that during this protest in your incident in Tshwane, we also had to deal with several other issues in the country, so it was not the only incident at the time. And then we would highlight some of the crimes that has been reported or the number of cases that's been reported, and then also just emphasize the specific cases of murder that's been linked to this specific unrest during that process, and then all protest and also then finish with a conclusion. Now, as we previously indicated at the time that the information was received by crime intelligence about the disruptive actions within Tshwane as a result of the nomination of the ANC mayoral candidate, the relevant sources and capabilities that we have within SAPT was then tasked at that time to gather the necessary information that was disseminated to our operational divisions for operational purposes. Now, the dissatisfaction with the Tshwane mayoral nominee candidate then resulted in various acts of violent protest and looting of shops belonging to both South African citizens and foreign nationals. This erupted on the 20th of June, more specifically in Sunnyside, Atrichville, Mamelodi, Garankwa, Luwate, Hammanskraal, Bronkhorstspruit, Ngubi, Mabopane, Rietgat, Hercules, and the Hercules informal settlement and Winterveld, and this continued until the 26th of June 2016. Now, just highlighting some of the areas that were affected during this incident. First of all, if you look at Sunnyside, it was the Tshwane Metro Police vehicle that was overturned in Arcadia. Looking at Atrichville, there was three shopping malls that are listed there. They looted also foreign national shops. The disruptions took place on the WF Mkomo Road, government premises, and train and substations. Now, on Kral, there's a number of routes that are listed there, the R101, M17, and N1, as well as the Pumulani and Carousel toll gates, where there were disruptions on the Stinkwater Road, Jubilee Mall, also involved in as the foreign national shops, Temba Shopping Center and the Kopanong Shopping Center, the Winterveld Community Hall, Municipal Office and Trace Stations. Moving to Mamelodi, it included the Mahubi Mall, the Municipal Offices, the Patco Bus Depot, then the Boom and Watu Shopping Centers, then foreign national shops, trace stations and hostels, as well as substations. Hercules, it included the Daspoort Tunnel, Bougainville, on the Rough Road, Sunset View Road and Mbopane Highway, the Hercules Train Station, Municipal Offices, Horns Neck, Mayen Intersection and also substations. Soshanguvi, the Soshanguvi Crossing, Mabopane and Thorntree Malls, Soshanguvi and Baatu Plaza, the Municipal Offices, Train and Substations, Foreign National Shops and Buitenkant Street in Rietgat. Pretoria Central, the areas affected was the municipal buildings, train stations, shopping malls, foreign national shops, liquor stores, Hermanstad and Marabastad, Patco Bus Depot, the Municipal Bus Depot, the Michael Brink Road, R80 and R101. Moving to Bronkhorstspruit, it was the municipal and IEC offices, clinics, foreign national shops, council and others, Ekangala Police Station and the township around Bronkhorstspruit, as well as the Patco Bus Depot. Now, at the time when the incident occurred, the South African Police Service adopted a specific operational concept that included the following fundamental principles to ensure that we had sufficient intelligence and information available on the incident. That includes the gathering thereof, to ensure that there is effective crowd management, to enhance police visibility in the areas that has been affected, to ensure that we provide the order that there is sufficient security at the city, within the city and at the identified malls, that we secure the operational key points, ensure that the routes affected are secured, that specialized operations are initiated where and when necessary, that the necessary airborne support is available, that the access control is provided once again where and when identified, railway security is implemented, and that all incidents that are reported during this time that they are properly investigated. The next two slides, I'm not going to go into the detail, just refers to the coordinating structures that were established, and you will note as far as all the relevant levels from national, provincial up to local level, the necessary coordinating structures were activated during the the incident, and that included all stakeholders that are listed within the blocks. That also applies to the next slide, and it's just important to note that all the areas included, the disciplines, intelligence, ICC, public, all the policing, Vispo, metros, detective, rapid rail, and the relevant communication structures. The total deployment over and above the normal policing that was initiated over the period included the following: Pretoria CBD 68, Hammanskraal 69 members, Mamelodi 41, Hercules 22, Sosangui 53. The numbers have been listed there. We also deployed 83 detectives, also detective 31 from the DPCI from PRASA, and the Rapid Rail Police, 85 employees and SAPs, 105 members that were deployed, private security 130, Department of Home Affairs 12, ESCOM 28, Metro Police 300, and Air Support 4. So during this period, the total deployment, if you look at the numbers, totals to 1,075. The operational focus areas that were classified as follows during the incident: the monitoring and or movement of public transport. We had to secure the focus on school premises, monitoring community movement on and day-to-day activities, securing government buildings, including municipal properties, to ensure that the public administration and the responsibilities of government continue without disruptions, securing the affected shopping malls, ESCOM substations, known targeted houses of councillors, national roads and access routes that are cleared, repaired and secured. We also had to ensure that the normal economic activity within the specific areas continue. And then we also had to address the hoax SMS threats which affected the normal daily activities of people. Interventions following the extensive SAS deployment in the affected areas were visible policing operations, and to stabilize these areas as well as intelligence operations against identified instigators. The situation was brought under control by 24 June 2016. These interventions were complemented by further interventions by community and political leaders who also assisted the South African Police Service and other stakeholders in this regard. It also needs to be mentioned, whilst the Tshwane Andre situation was unfolding, the South African Police Service had to deal with a number of issues all over the country. And this also required the South African Police Service to deploy resources to areas such as Galvindale, in the Eastern Cape, where we had to deal with gang-related issues, Wuhan in Limpopo, Cleveland's and KwaMashu hospitals, as well as Nongoma in KwaZulu-Natal. So the other protest action, as we referred to, would basically lead to that South African resources that we had available for deployment at the time were stretched to the maximum to deal with all the protest actions that related to a number of issues, including political intolerance, that included dissatisfaction with nominated ward councillors, community protest actions relating to issues such as demands for water, electricity and employment, occupation of land, and reaction to evictions, instability at education institutions, labor issues, as well as conflict in the transport sector. Now, the areas are listed there. We are also not going to go into the details as far as this is concerned, but the number of areas where we had to intervene at the same time, they are being listed there, and you will note if you look at the slide, it's quite a significant number of places at the time where the South African Police Service need to intervene. So during the crime that's been reported, specifically focusing on the incident with Ntwane, the total number of cases, if I go to the next slide, number 17, I will move back now, you will note that a total of 353 cases were reported at the time. The highest number, if I will go through the two slides, in terms of the first column reported, is Atrix Will with 87 on the first page, followed by Mamelodi East with 15 and Silverton 12. But on the next page, we'll also note Luati with 71, Rikha with 73, Acacia with 32, and Mabupane with 14. In total, if we just look at the total column at the bottom for the total row, 353 cases reported, 107 has been referred to court, 187 of those are currently still under investigation. The total number of suspects arrested is 278. The number that we're talking about that I want to highlight is on that slide, Duarte 94 suspects, Rikha 37, Garapua 44, and on the previous page, Mamelodi East is a total of 23. Looking at the court process, you will note that we are not really seeing results at the moment because these incidents recently happened, and we must allow for the investigation process to unfold. Looking at the specific successes, focusing on some of the clusters within Tshwane, that is the charges, possession of suspected stolen goods, one case and three suspects arrested. Legal firearms possession is also one case, one suspect arrested, with the totals listed below. Tshwane West, stolen goods, suspected stolen goods, four cases, five suspects arrested. Possession of dangerous weapon, one case, two suspects arrested. Tshwane East, possession of suspected stolen goods, one plus one arrested. Possession of unlicensed firearm, one plus one suspect arrested. Tshwane North, possession of stolen goods, number of cases 49, suspect arrested 58. Possession of unlicensed firearm, two plus two cases and two suspects arrested. And possession of dangerous weapon, one case with four suspects arrested. That gives you a total of 52 cases with 64 suspects that were arrested. Now, just highlighting some of the cases that the prominent cases that were reported during this incident and giving some of the detail. On 2016-04-12, members of the EFF were at the specific hostel in Tembisa to hold an election campaign rally. They were assaulted by an unknown resident with fungus, hotkeys, and other weapons. Several members of the EFF were admitted to a hospital, and then one of them, Mr. Edward, Setsi Edward Motibe, sustained serious head injuries, and he passed away on the 6th of June this year. No suspects have thus far been identified or arrested, and this case is still under investigation. Moving to the case in Pretoria West, on 2016-06-19, the ANC Regional Executive Committee held a meeting regarding the nomination of the mayoral candidate for Tshwane at the Tshwane Centre's Church in the St. Burger Street, Pretoria West. An argument broke out between members of the ANC, and outside the meeting, and Mr. Simon Modine, an ANC member, was shot and died on the scene. A suspect was arrested, as indicated there on the 28th of June. He is also a member of the ANC, and the case was remanded until 11 August for further investigation. And as far as the investigation is concerned, we are still waiting for the post-mortem report as well as the blood alcohol results. The third case is Mamelodi East on the 21st of June 2016, in extension 22 in Mamelodi East. The body of Mr. Piri was found in the street with a gunshot wound to the chest. No suspect has yet been arrested, and the circumstances surrounding his death is still not clear, but it is suspected that his death could be linked with the looting of shops that took place during the day in that area. Mamelodi is still with Mamelodi East on the 22nd of June 2016 at 4:45. Mr. Daniels was found with a gunshot wound to his back. According to the witnesses, he was traveling in a vehicle which was stopped by two foreign nationals who confronted him. One took out a firearm and shot the deceased while he was running away. It is also suspected that this is linked to the looting of shops that took place in the vicinity. Up to this day, no suspects have been identified or arrested, and investigation is still ongoing. Still with Mamelodi East, on the 22nd of June, at the address identified, Mr. Masupa was found with a gunshot wound to his chest. It was, during the investigation, it was revealed that he was part of a group who looted shops in the area and was shot by foreign nationals. So this incident is also currently being linked to the looting of shops that took place at the time of the incident. It is still ongoing, and no suspects have yet been arrested and or identified. Duarte, on the 23rd of June, the resident attacked the Central City Mall. After the situation was stabilized, the body of Mr. Makadu was found next to the ATM inside the mall with a gunshot wound to the chest. On the next day, at 6 o'clock, the body of Mr. Bafana Mbada was found with a gunshot wound to the chest in an alley next to the Central City Mall. It's suspected that both the victims mentioned were participating in the looting of shops in the Central City Mall, and that they were shot by unknown security guards. Up to now, no witnesses could have been traced, and no suspects have been identified, and the investigation is continuing. In conclusion, as a result of the immediate intervention that was initiated by the Johns and through the deployment of additional personnel, the situation was then stabilized. And at the same time, it's important to note that these interventions were supported by community leaders and political leaders that assisted the South African Police Service and other stakeholders. The state authority was successful, reclaimed, perpetrators were arrested immediately, and looted items were returned to lawful owners. And then since the incident, Tshwane remains stable even through the election process. Thank you, Honourable Chief.
Thank you, General Pahoni.
Thanks, Chief, for your presentation.
Thank you very much. Members' questions, Honourable Abati. It's, I see that here.
We saw, let me first maybe thank SAPS once more. That analyst was really very, very strong. But Sabutan Police Service was up to the task. They managed to retain it, otherwise we would have seen more bloodshed. We really commend you, because I was there. We even saw some members on footage, or people sent us some pictures where a staff member was also looting. He was, on the other hand, he was carrying the firearm, that the other hand was carrying millimeter. What happened to the police who were looting? My next question is on this unknown security guard. In a mall, the guards that are there obviously should be a registered security company that is known to be working there. So on slide 27, when you speak of this unknown security guard, I do not understand how are they unknown in that mall. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. My question is on page 23, the last bullet. The transmortem and alcohol report is still being awaited. How long does it take? And my question is from the other presentation. I want to you to explain to us about the deployment plan during 2016 LGA. Did not, does it affect a day-to-day policing at station level? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mopi.
Thank you, Chairperson. On slide number 12, the very last bullet point, folks, Adam Estras, which affected normal daily activity. I just want to understand what that is all about. My second question would be on foreign nationals and their use of weapons. Usually, are the weapons that are used licensed, or what usually happens? Because at some stage, you find that it's just wild west for them. They are in a party and shooting and so on. I'm just worried whether they are legally in the country, because there's a possibility that they are illegal in the country using illegal weapons, and what do we do about that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Shlongo.
No, thank you, Chairperson. No, one first must appreciate the difficulty under which our men, women in blue have been subjected to in that particular area. But, Chairperson, I would like to first know, you know, as I was following the news there very strongly, I don't think I was going to catch it somewhere in the given stance of this, so that one can actually have the glimpse of an eyesight as to what is that is actually happening there, or what's happening there. When the mayoral candidate, Jogo Dikiza's car, I understand when she was, when I think the bodyguard was fueling in one of the filling stations, was ambushed and riddled with a number of bullets. In such a way that I understand that the driver of that car ended up escaping on foot, which I think maybe some kind of exhibit or evidence might be there on the spot to give some kind of clues to the police, so that we can then be able to understand what is it that is in happening there. The reason I'm raising this is because a political decision, my understanding, has been taken by the organization through which the former mayor comes from. And my surprise, Mr. Jefferson, when I had him also post-election, just it was a mistake for ANC to have actually removed him. And then I just began to smell the red to say, what was then happening here? If then that person who was seen to be accompanying their then candidate could then actually then utter such words. Now, it's quite appalling. And lastly, the question that says to me, under a given circumstance, in that whole community area, do we have maybe a well-functioning kind of community policing structures? And if then we do, have they been so, how have they been communicating or assisting police in terms of stabilizing the area? Have they been able to function effectively in terms of communicating the genuine information? Because I was told that some senior leaders were mobilizing the community through meetings and all that to go among. Anyway, now, so that at the end of the day we can then be able to find out and then be able to see whether our democracy is actually then on the verge of a particular threat, and if so, what then needs to be done in future in order to ensure that we don't allow such a pure anarchistic kind of an act to happen. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Actually, my question leads on from the end of what Honourable Mkhilanga was saying, which was I was going to ask the Acting Commissioner, what are the lessons that the judges have to share with us, learned from the Tshwane unrest, in particular the preventive measures to mitigate and ensure better readiness in future for any such flare-ups anywhere else in the country, because the Acting Commissioner did allude that the Tshwane situation did catch them off guard. So just to get a sense and an assurance of what's been the analysis, what's going to be put in place to bolster and beef up and ensure better preparedness and response for future.
Thanks, Chair. Toshin Gubi is actually under my constituency. I think I share that to the Deputy President. And I'm always in touch with a lot of the WhatsApp groups that take place, the civilian WhatsApp groups. And a lot of the time they send information that you think to yourself, well, hopefully the police are also involved with many WhatsApp groups in terms of gathering information. And if that is the case, then the Tshwane violence could not have been a surprise. Because on the night of the announcement, when Putnam knew that she wasn't getting nominated, there was apparently a meeting that already took place in a hotel. Now, of course, it's not for us. We've got no investigating powers, but nowhere is it mentioned in this report about either refuting such an allegation or saying that that allegation was investigated. But it does go to show that a lot about what took place is not really contained in the report. Now, before we pat ourselves on the back and how far ourselves and how quickly we responded and how great the response was, I think we need to appreciate that this is unprecedented. It's not like the xenophobic violence that was sporadic and took place all over and that would take a week to quell. This is something that escalated, and by the time it escalated to the point it did, in an exercise of empathy, to have people sleeping and with their children, to hear the gunshot and to tell the children, look, we don't know, it's not thunder, but we don't know, you know, the police must have it under control, but you can imagine the scene that we're playing out must have sounded like war taking place. And then one of the concerns that took place, and it echoed my colleague over there, the police even say to you, thank you, Honourable Bonavante, that the police even say to you that it's far easier to buy a gun in Soshanguve than it is a pack of peanuts. And I actually concur with it. Now, again, when we're looking for a result, we take intelligence firsthand. We say that intelligence must be a prevention. So instead of us being reactive, we would be proactive on intelligence. Now, something like choosing another mayoral candidate out of the current mayoral candidates, people must be aware that there's going to be something that transpires or possible transpiration from this event. And then, of course, we deploy around this. In Bronkhorst, I would suggest, from what I was reading on WhatsApp and the xenophobic groups and all those WhatsApp groups, they were almost two separate sets of violence. The one was almost community-orientated over an area, over unhappiness in an area, and the other one was in exactly what we're saying, that caused the Tshwane unrest. Am I right in that assumption? Is that possibly that we're looking at two different scenarios within the same event? That whilst the Tshwane violence was taking place over the mayoral candidates, there was actually Bronkhorst race as a community unrest that took place over service delivery. And why I raise that is the lessons learned there, that this so easily could have spiraled out into something far worse. You know, we're talking about nearly a state of emergency which could have caused a delay in elections or something like that. So, you know, or further devaluation in the rand. These lessons that we learn here, we must make sure that the debrief is elaborate here so that we learn in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe just one observation from my side. I think that not a lot of analysts have looked at, I think, and maybe we get comment from the acting national commissioner. I think maybe one positive element of handling Tshwane unrest was the execution of minimum restraint from the police side. That's a total change in philosophy. So back to basis approach driven by the acting national commissioner and the management team, I think is very good. It's been a very, I think, a very extensive operation. So I just want to know, in terms of the training, we don't talk about possibly this week, but you have the National Intervention Unit in RICS, other units. Is that back to basics process also now influencing your doctrine? Because if you look, there was not civilian casualties in terms of the police. So it's minimum restraint, although there was some physical buildings and so on, but I mean in terms of the human aspect, it's a change in approach. That's very positive, I think, from a philosophy point of view. And I just want to know, is that now part of your training approach also in both practices?
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Maybe the question raised by Honorable Mulevati in terms of the WhatsApp pictures. Actually, those WhatsApp pictures were wrong. Our members were retrieving stolen goods and taking them back for loading in the car so that they could be taken to the station. Unfortunately, people who have got ill intentions were portraying those members as looting, which was not the case. If I'm not wrong, we at the stage issued a statement talking to that particular issue. There were indeed some members that were caught looting. For example, at Central City, there were two members from Soshanguve Police Station, Akashine, who were found in possession of the goods. They were immediately arrested. They are suspended. Their cases are being processed as we speak. But all those others that were on the WhatsApp and whatever, unfortunately, they were meant to portray us as criminals when we are actually doing our work. I don't know why did they not take our pictures when we were busy retrieving all those goods. We went one, was it a Friday evening, to social media Duarte. You would have seen the amount of goods that came out of houses in the particular area. Honorable Chair, the issue of the unknown security guard is because this is at the point when the case was reported, the identity of these people were not known. But the process is underway of, for example, doing forensic work to be able to get to that determination, because even if there were, for example, 20 security guards that were employed there, there will be one or two of them whose firearms would have been used. So we will, at the end of the day, get to the identity of those. We say they are unknown at this stage because we don't know precisely who was responsible for that particular act. Honorable Muller's question, Chair, on slide 23, post-mortem and the blood alcohol test, which is awaited. I will unfortunately not tell how long it takes because this is processed within the forensic chemistry laboratories of the Department of Health. So we are dependent on an outcome from there, but we will continue following up to make sure that these cases are processed accordingly. There's a question you raised, how the local government election deployment impacted on normal policy as advanced? No, it did not. If it were to have impacted on normal policy, it would have been mainly on the administration related duties, considering that we have taken people from national headquarters, from the provincial offices, deployed them on the ground, including those that were taken from who were supposed to be on rest day or on leave. But ordinary, normal day-to-day policing was not affected. In actual fact, it was enhanced in that police visibility was on the increase. So the police were much more accessible because they were all over, which serves us well from a back-to-basics approach, because we said police will be characterized by visibility. Honorable Chair, Honorable Marcus, question, the hoax SMS is affecting daily activity. What we mean here is that someone is saying at the corner of this street, this is happening. So now you move the resources from there, you come here where nothing is happening. So it's some kind of a diversion. Now you don't take any of those SMSs or calls very lightly. You still respond, but unfortunately, in some instances, it is a tactic to take the focus of the police away from where the real problem is. If that was not the case, we will be much more effective concentrating ourselves in the space where the challenge is. So that's exactly what we mean in this regard. On the firearms, Honorable Chair, many of the firearms possessed by foreign nationals, particularly those that are operating like your spaza shops and so on, those are not licensed firearms. In many instances, we find firearms used being unlicensed. And that is why we have prioritized this particular area in terms of the firearms that are being possessed in that space. Not every foreign national's firearm is unlicensed. There are those that would have followed processes to get the permit, especially when it comes to those that are coming for hunting and so on. They would have processed their firearms accordingly. But in the main, those which we find, for example, involved, like where they is looting of foreign nationals, in many instances, those firearms are unlicensed. The issue, point raised by Honorable Msongo relating to the mayoral candidate chair is foreign to us. We hear for the first time. We don't have any report suggesting that that kind of an incident happened. But the way it is said, it would have been serious. There is no way that it would not have came to our attention. So I can confirm that there is no such on our records, on Robert Chen. The community policy structures, I can't say that they were effective during the process of the election. I think, I mean, during the unrest, it was a challenging situation. Many a time situations like this are left to the police, and we have to manage. We do appreciate the role that some political leaders played in helping to diffuse the situation by engaging the communities. We saw leaders on the ground. Of course, they will still be under attack, but to us it went a long way in contributing towards restoring order in those communities. Honorable Mbele's question, Chair, on lessons learned, I think we have learned a great deal out of this. One is that as a police we're very effective. Secondly, that no situation can be taken for granted. Thirdly, the importance of intelligence to enable proactive policing. It can never be overemphasized. Also, we continue to learn that irresponsible statements by people in leadership positions it remains a problem, and that's why we continue to call upon leaders to help us ease pressure on the resources of the police, because we can't allow a situation where tensions are being fueled. Many of the people that were involved in the 20, if you were to ask them today, what did you benefit? They don't know. This was to benefit the few. I think not only the police, but as a country, we must learn from Tony, we must learn from what happened in Vuane, but we can pride ourselves that the police will always learn, they will do what they are supposed to be doing, and in that process, we obviously will appreciate everyone taking their rightful place in society to make sure that we restore order. Deployment, of course, you get stretched. What you will always appreciate is the willingness of our members when the situation calls for them, to go an extra mile. Because when you are confronted with a funny-like situation, the 8-hour thing or the 12-hour thing is academic. They go long hours. But to know that they are willing to do it, it's a good thing. I think as management, it gives us it leaves us with a feeling of pride to know that we have those that are very patriotic and loyal to this country. Honorable Chair, the issue raised by Honorable Bergman, yeah. We would have investigated all this, including the meeting referred to in Arcadia. But I don't think, Chair, this is a platform where we want to present all the details, because some of these are at an operational level. So the issues relating to Tony were taken care of. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of the WhatsApp group referred to. I'm not a participant there. Because for me, it's not about rumors, it's about verified intelligence that has to be processed, and you have to fall back to something. We did get a lot from the community in terms of look at this, look at that, and that itself was threatening us. We are aware that people would have been sold. We have done it in Atchezville. We have done it in Mamelodi. Why are you doing it in Haramkua? Why are you not doing it there? And it happened. So that is why earlier when we responded to the question of a third force, we say criminality would have been a factor in there. And that's why we will continue to say it was not everyone. There was a group which is small that was behind this, and we will continue to do our work in pursuing. I would have appreciated more information on this. Maybe the honourable member will provide me at some point. It's easier to buy a gun than buying a packet of peanuts. If there's one thing that we are after, are illegal firearms. Because we know their contribution in criminality. Just in Gauteng alone, a week ago I was talking to the provincial commissioner. From the 10th of August to the 10th of August, we have recovered 210 illegal firearms. So wherever a firearm is, we will go and find it. We can't leave it and take it for granted. It's an area where, for example, our intelligence is focused on. We continue to get that information, and it's being followed. So if there is something that we don't know, which the honourable member is aware of, I'll appreciate that information so that we can follow it up. Honourable Chair, I'm glad that you raised the issue of restraint, not only during the Tshwane, but you know that we are, since October we have said, one of the things that we are going to do is to ensure that we take police back to basics. And we have said our operations will be characterized by visibility, but there will be response where the response, the situation demands from us to respond, and we will exercise maximum restraint. So if you look at all this, it would have been fees must fall, Africans must fall, because they have been coming and going, you know, all of them. You will find it difficult to get some casualties from the police. Not that there will not be any, because the nature of our job, depending on what is being directed at us, may result in that. But I'm really proud of members of the organization to continue to exercise that restraint. And it is not only invisible policing, Chair, that the back to basics is resident, it's across the board. Even in our specialized units, the NIU and so on, because we just want to do that what we were employed to do. And yes, the back to basics approach has found its way into the training programs. Particularly, you go to the basic training program, the pattern we will produce at the end of this year will be a different pattern in what we have exposed them to. I think some people in our country may have had a taste of what we are referring to. In the Western Cape, we hosted a passing out parade, I think just before the elections, where we were graduating 1,926 of young men and women, 1,324 of them only for the Western Cape. And you would have seen how beautiful they look. I hope that they keep shape. They don't balloon in the process. But because back to basics is a reality, the risk is less of them ballooning. We went on to Pretoria. I think we graduated there, 1,715 of young men and women who are now policing as we speak. So it has indeed found its way there, and it will continue to characterize the work that we do in the police. We are very grateful of the the members having received it well, but also the members of the public. We get very good feedback to say it's exactly what we wanted from the police, just to focus on their work and maintain the posture. Thank you, sir.
Let's go to the briefing of the appointments. We've also asked police management to brief us on the level 14 and 15 appointments since 1 April, so that we know who is the new crop of leaders that's been appointed in key positions in terms of regional commissioners as well as cluster commanders, and any changes. So over to SAPS for that. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thank you. As you indicated, there was a request that we just brief the committee on the appointment that's been made since on level 15 and 14, that is Major General and Lieutenant General, from the 1st of April to date. So there's going to be a brief presentation just talking to the appointments, the DEEP itself, the status on the implementation of the structure, the equity profiles, and then the appointments on the identified level 15, and then also dealing with the appointments on level 14. Now, just giving you an overview of the appointments that took place over this specific period. Remember, this is from the 1st of April until where we stand today. If you look at the total composition of salary level 15 and salary level 14, as indicated in the first donut chart, 41 out of the 43 appointments were at the level of Major General. That's 95%, and two people were appointed at the level of Lieutenant General. That represents 5% of the total appointments. If you move to the donut on the right-hand side, out of the 43 appointments that were made, 36 or 84% of that was made at provincial level, and 7 of the appointments was done at 36 or 84% was done at provincial level, and 7 or 16% was done at regional level. If you did a breakdown at the bottom, where it is indicated how many of the appointments were made in the specific divisions and provinces, you will note that the Eastern Cape, there were 3, Free State 5, Gauteng 3, KZN 3, then Limpopo and Mpumalanga 6 each, Northwest and Northern Cape 3 each, and the Western Cape 4, and then in the different divisions, Counterintelligence 1, Crime Intelligence and ORS, Operational Response Services 2 each, and then 1 each in Protection and Security Services and Visible Policing. As far as the race and gender composition is concerned of the appointment that were made in the 43, now the data is gone. Wait, I just need to just give me a second, I'll pull it up on my computer. Okay, I have it here. It's in terms of the race and gender composition, the first African male, there's 18, that represents 42% of the appointments made. African female, 15, that represents 35%. Colored female was 1, that represents 2% of the appointments. Colored male, 3, that represents 7%. Indian male and Indian female, 1 each, that represents 2% respectively of the appointments made, and then white female, 2, that represents 5%, and white male, 2, that represents 5% of the appointment made. So you will note that as far as the race and gender composition is concerned, that the majority of appointments were made in the category African female, African male. As I indicated, 35% and 42% respectively. So in terms of the, just a quick breakdown of the relevant provinces, how many people were appointed, it's just going to indicate to you by the general total of 41. You will note that it's not going to repeat the previous slide, 2 in Eastern Cape, Free State 5, Gauteng 3, 3 in KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo 5, Mpumalanga 6, Northwest, Northern Cape 3 each, Western Cape 4, and then the relevant regions at national level as indicated there. And as far as the Lieutenant Generals are concerned, you will note that one has been appointed as the Provincial Commissioner in the Eastern Cape, and one has been appointed as the Provincial Commissioner in Limpopo Province, and that gives you a total of 43 countrywide since the 1st of April. As far as the implementation of the structures that were presented to the committee is concerned, we've implemented it at 8 of the 9 provinces. The Northern Cape is coming Friday, and it's important to note that this process is led or facilitated by the National Commissioner personally, so The National Commissioner is visiting each one of the provinces, facilitating the process, and as indicated, 8 of the 9 completed. Northern Cape will follow this coming Friday. And then head office divisions, it's partially implemented. That has been prioritized to happen after we've dealt with the provinces. So as soon as all the provinces have been dealt with, the process to do the necessary activities at national divisions will be initiated. Just the detail of the persons that's been appointed in DIF, if the two provincial commissioners for Limpopo and Eastern Cape, it's Lieutenant General Letwaba in the Limpopo and Lieutenant General Nzinga in the Eastern Cape. As I said, both of them as provincial commissioners. The major generals that have been appointed, counterintelligence, Major General Zima, crime intelligence, two of them, is Major General Challen and Major General Tiu, both of them as provincial heads, the one in Northwest and the other one in the Western Cape. At ORS, two appointments, Major General Kwanazi and Major General Chilembe, the one for public order policing and the other one for border policing. PSS, Major General Mogo, the head of VIP protection services. Visible policing, Major General Botka as the head of firearm liquor and second-hand goods. In the province of Eastern Cape, Major General Hansi as the provincial deputy provincial commissioner of fiscal resource management, and Major General Force as the cluster commander of Ndansane. Free State, Major General Mudisi, Cluster Commander Belkom, Major General Dumbane, Deputy Provincial Commissioner Asset Management, Major General Molloy, Chava Cluster, Major General Lucia, Mangaung Cluster, and Major General Sotsetsi, BTM Cluster Commander. Gauteng, Major General Pason as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner HRM, Major General Subia as the Cluster Commander Ekurhuleni Central, and Major General Mosepe as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner for Crime Detection. KwaZulu-Natal, Major General Gonyama as the Cluster Commander Amayuba, Major General Makoba as the Cluster Commander Zululand, KwaZulu-Natal, and Major General Namakele as the Cluster Commander Ugu, KwaZulu-Natal. And Limpopo, Major General Skeepers as the Cluster Commander Polokwane, Major General Linda as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner Crime Detection, Major General Morakaradi as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner HRM, Major General Molowusi as the Cluster Commander Toyando, and Major General Ngobeni as the Cluster Commander Diane. Mpumalanga, Major General De Beer, Provincial Legal Services, Major General Mashika as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner Asset Management, Major General Mohale as the Deputy Provincial Commissioner Crime Detection, Major General Mashele, Cluster Commander Icon Hook, Major General Lin Suhani as Cluster Commander Kwamaslanga, and Major General Kaba as the Cluster Commander Tonga. Major General Northwest, Major General Adams, Cluster Commander Rattenburg, Major General Pretorius, Cluster Commander Klapsdorp, and Major General Makwane as the Cluster Commander Brits. So I forgot to mention, as you know, you will see that there is buttons to the right, yellow buttons of plus Mahani. Those identify the senior officers being appointed in terms of the revised structure, the new structure. Northern Cape, Major General Nguni as the Deputy Provincial Commission of Operational Services, and Major General Pevu as the Provincial Legal Services Northern Cape. And then just to note again that this coming Friday we will be visiting the Northern Cape to finalize the process in that regard. Western Cape, Major General Mbeki, Provincial Legal Services, Major General Memela as the Cluster Commander Nyanga, Major General Monkey as the Cluster Commander Tigerberg, Major General Jordan, Milnerton Cluster, Major General Lincoln as the Cluster Commander Winelands. Honorable Chair, that is the appointments that's been made on that level since the 1st of April up to date.
Thank you, Chair. In addition to the presentation, we do have the profiles of all the individuals referred to, which we will provide to the Secretary. And maybe the second thing, General Ravik can go back there where he has got the circle and the plus. Those, as he quickly indicated, are positions that we have filled in implementing the new cluster structure. Those posts, Chair, we did not advertise. These are the posts which we have filled through, Section 45. It was critical for us to do that because we have realized that command and control was an issue. And we had to make sure that we put management in place so that we don't have an excuse of why policing in a particular cluster is not being managed accordingly. But we took into consideration a number of factors. You have got people here who have been on the same rank for 16 years, so 20 years. I think the one brigadier here in Brigadier Lincoln, who was at Cape Town Central, I think he'd been 20 years on the level of brigadier. We made him a major general in this regard. And as the general said, we will do our last province this Friday before we focus more at national, because the intention was to make sure that we build capacity at station level. So when we look at the national structures, it is possible that we are going to find people being relocated to the station or the cluster level where we have got some challenges. In the process, we have implemented, as I said, the cluster structure. You have now in some clusters already the cluster commander and the deputy cluster commander. What we did not do, which is something that I think when we spoke to the structure, we are not going to be doing, is that deputy station commander's position because of the budgetary constraints. I mean, the compensation budget is not growing. So if you take everyone, you are recycling the same people and you are going to have capacity at the production level. So to try and close that gap, that's when we elected in the deputy cluster commander in the equation. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Members' comments, questions? Honorable Abatsi, Honorable
Nobita? Jefferson, this is very encouraging. You know, and it definitely it will boost up even the morale of the police for them to know that if I'm doing my work exceptionally well, somebody is recognizing me and so on, you know. This is very, very encouraging. But my question is this Major General Botma, the Botma I know, the one who was at CFR. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the lighter note, it's like the acting lead commissioner is Prophet Khan. Why? Because my question is about the promotion, and he talked about the section 45. But then I'll still ask that question so that maybe he can further clarify me so that I understand. The question is, when last did your office accordingly promote the lower rank personnel of different divisions at local stations? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Other members,
Honorable
Marking. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to clarify myself. Some time ago, I used to think, or if you are in the police force or you are in the defense force, and maybe you study or you do whatever, then there's automatic promotion. But I was made to understand that it's like you are a civil servant. There must be a post that you must apply for if it's vacant. And it was very difficult for me to understand that, meaning that you can do whatever you want if somebody doesn't die or a new post is created or there's something vacant, then you can stay in the same position for 20 years. And, well, I don't know how it works, but it just sounds very unfair. Maybe the section 45, I don't know what it says, maybe if you can explain it for me. And one other thing, seemingly, if you want to be transferred to some area next to where you stay, I mean to understand you yourself must get somebody there whom you can exchange with. Honestly, it's on you to do that. And I'm not sure whether that must, the person must be on the same rank with yourself or what happened. I just want to understand the dynamics there, because what it means, it means I can remain a constable after I've got my master's for 20 years. If that is what it means. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Sheikh. I think I must just highlight that at first blush, I am quite happy to see that there's emphasis on putting attention to the cluster level. That was an issue that the committee had picked up on previously, especially in the Free State, with our committee oversight visit there. And to restore the issue of command and control, as the acting commissioner said, I think accounted about half of the 41 appointments are cluster commanders. So I'm glad to see that it is being covered. Chief, my two questions are: could the acting commissioner just clarify for me the Section 45 that was invoked? Is that Section 45 in the regulations or in the Statutes Act? Because I was just checking now so I could see for myself what it says. Section 45 in the Statutes Act refers to retirement. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong document. Just where the Section 45 is so I can go back and study it myself and better understand. Because there's lots of regulations that are at play in the policing environment. And then my second question, Chair, while we are on the issue of senior appointments, Lieutenant General Ngobeni in KwaZulu-Natal had her suspicion lifted by the High Court. Could the Acting Commissioner please just give us a quick status update on what's happening there? I understand it was a technical procedural issue, so it's still the substantive matter of the allegations that she was initially suspended on. Could we just get an update of where we are with that and what the next 10 step is so we can ensure that accountability still follows through? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, members. That's the questions. Thank you. Sorry, Honourable Mula. Sorry.
Thank you, the President. I want to ask this question because, according to me, when I was working in the Dogs Unit in 1995, I know that when a constable works in a police force, after 2 years, if she's got 2 years or 3 years, they get promoted to a sergeant. But now, some constables, when they are saying they are not promoted, they've got 15 years in the constable post. So I don't know what happens. Does it change or what? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, General.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Honourable Mulibati is not here, but the answer to the question is yes. That's Brigadier Bootman, who has always been within the Central Firearm Register Environment, who was redeployed elsewhere, and following the advertisement of the post, he was subsequently appointed in the post. I want to get to the details. I'll get back to Honourable Mavija's question just now, Chair. Maybe the question of Honourable Maki, automatic promotion, I think it links to what Honourable Mula is raising. It's no more the case. It used to be the case in olden days where at the time constable was to be 2 years on the rank of constable, then he or she will, following acquiring of certain qualifications, be moved to a sergeant, and another 2 years being a sergeant before warrant, and I think it was 1 year between warrant officer and lieutenant. That process if the dawn of democracy, new policies were instituted and posed on certain level, or promotion on certain level is informed by the availability of posts. So they are post bound. But we have now at that level, although the general members are not happy with it, what you call a progression, what is it, rank progression. So they are not happy because it takes too long. Remember, I used to say 2 years. Now it takes 7 years after training before that person can progress to another level. That's now the automatic part. But nothing stops. If, for example, a sergeant's post is advertised, if that person who do not have 7 years, as long as he meets the requirements, will then get promoted to or appointed to that particular post. So in this case, I'm trying to deal with both Honorable Marge and Honorable Wuna's question. In the main, the mobility is informed by the availability of posts. It is not automatic, for example, that the post, let's say I'm sitting in this post as a kennel, which is level 12. Then the post level is being reviewed. It now becomes a brigadier's post. It is not automatic that the incumbent will automatically move to that level 13 brigadier's post. It will still be advertised. Yes, we can invoke, for example, the section 45 and say, because this person is already there, has met all the requirements, there is no point in having the post advertised. We can just use the allowed processes to have the person appointed. One of the reasons, Honorable Chair, on a lighter note, why I did not become a teacher, I always said, no, I can't become a teacher because I must first wait for the principal to die before, you know, I come into the equation for a principal's position. So I at least had knowledge that in the police there was mobility. That's how I came into the police. But looks like that situation has caught up with us also in the police. But we continue to engage at SSC level as part of a way of ensuring that we improve on the morale of the people looking at all these factors and see how they could be processed. I quickly want to go back to the question of Honorable Madisha. If you recall, somewhere in December, we had the promotion processes that was long on hold following the challenge by Solidarity, and then we went into some discussions that resulted in the promotions being released. So it was in December that we have promoted people on levels, and we have done it now again. I think effective from the 1st of October, we have appointed, I can just give the total numbers here, 15,144 members. That's promotions, 131 kennels, 833 left kennels, 2,112 captains, 3,282 warrant officers, and 3,505 sergeants. And there was also a progression for, appointment for the Public Service Act, because those are some I refer to members appointed in terms of the Police Act. The others, level 1, 3,316, 293, level 4, 222, level 6, and 1,414, level 7. So the process is underway. If you recall, we were interdicted with this process. There was an outcome which had a relationship with the employment equity challenge in the Department of Correctional Services. But despite that, we went into a consultation with Solidarity and we were able to find common ground. So we are now in the process of revising our employment equity plan and we will not long initiate the promotion process again for the coming financial year. So in short, it's not the big chiefs that are benefiting only, also the food soldiers on the ground do benefit, they are well looked after.
That's a follow-up question.
This is 1st October 2016. Yeah. The next one, we are initiating it now because Honourable Chair, we just concluded. So the next phase, we are looking at close to 3,000. 3,000, which will be effective the 1st of January 2017, which means between now and then we will have advertised and go through the processes. Yes, they will be looked after. Yeah, there will also 7,812 progression, which comes into effect now in October. That is now your constables, sergeants, warrant officers, 7,800, which we will be taking care of. Okay. The one question, Chair, if I had an option, I was not going to answer this one because I try to respect the individuals involved in respect of General Ngobeni, but that process has not escaped us. There is a challenge to the outcome of the decision that was communicated, and as we speak, there is an active provincial commissioner who continues to do work in the province. So legal processes have been activated accordingly. Thank you, Chair.
Members, very short. I want to come to the desk because the dilemma is we're busy currently with the Chapter 11 solution, and this venue has been used at 1 o'clock for Chapter 9 institutions election. So I just want to round off. But it should allow the
President, there was a question that I asked about if you want to be transferred nearer to home, what is the process, and so on. Thank you.
The Commissioner has indicated that he's going to answer my question that he missed here about Citizen 45.
Sorry, Honourable Members, is that all questions, all follow-ups?
Okay, maybe one other thing. If I'm a constable, can I, and with all qualifications, can I apply for a rank of Lieutenant General, or do I have to go through the progression, sergeant, warrant officer, lieutenant, or can I just jump directly to and apply for a vacant post of Lieutenant General?
I think it's not even possible.
Honourable Chair, thanks. It is not impossible for that constable to apply, but if he or she may find it difficult to be appointed because of the requirements which will, for example, require experience. I know that when we are sitting tomorrow, I am sitting on two posts, the Divisional Commissioner, Human Resources, Utilization and Legal Services, which are Lieutenant General's positions. I can bet the Honourable Mark, I'm going to find a constable who has got a legal qualification, but who has not practiced, who has never managed anywhere, which will place me at risk if I were to consider that person. So preferably, the person must be able to go through the ranks and gain the necessary experience to go there. In terms of the transfer, Honourable Chair, it is not only based on the member having to find someone, because we will not only approve and inform by whether there is someone that can come, we will evaluate the application, the merit thereof, and consider approval. What we will maybe look at going forward is the issue of if I don't, if because it does happen that a commander is saying, I am not able to let you go if I don't find a replacement. So there is a provision in the appeals mechanism that we are able to say, but you can't only be selfish and you retain this person, but also make that allowance for the person to move, and we then allocate a post to that environment for it to be filled again, because the person is not necessarily moving with the post. He or she goes to fill a vacant post somewhere, and this vacant one gets filled in the process. Oh yeah, the National Transfer Committee, which is also in place. Okay, I just wanted to take the general, not the general honourable member's question offline on this one, if you don't mind, sir. Okay, but it is more in terms of the Police Act. The provision is in terms of the Police Act that empowers the appointment without advice by the National Commissioner. But of course, it's not a provision that can be used recklessly. It's based on need. Thanks for that motion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, honourable members, for your participation in today's meeting. Hopefully we're going to have the same numbers on Friday morning at 9 when we reconvene for the discussion on the rural safety process. Maybe just to say that I think we take note of the progress that's been made in terms of the appointments and also the cluster heads. It's important that we've got the necessary skills at the various levels to ensure that the back-to-back mandate is further strengthened, so we welcome that. We also take note of presentations on the municipal election appointment. I think in general there's appreciation for the role played by South African Police Services. I think we take also note of the state state and crime intelligence, but we have to strengthen that area further to ensure that we don't cut unnecessary surprises and that we stabilize the communities as we go forward. I think it's also important to note that there's been progress also with relation to training and also appointments by mention of the new recruits that graduated as police members around the country. I think they've also ensured that in terms of numbers, SAPS is able to deal with the various tasks in the various provinces. I've indicated that we will meet in on Friday with regard to rural safety, that issue, and next week on the public order policing issue. I might just maybe highlight, we haven't discussed it, but there was invitation to us from the Home Affairs Committee to engage regarding the water management entity, agency that's come to the fore. But I think from the Police Committee, we'll also have to discuss that, because there's constitutional issues also at play in terms of the rule of the role of the South African Police Service. So I think that's my issue we will also put on the table in the next few weeks. So thank you very much, General. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.